Do you suffer from arthritis or have weak joints? Is it making your life hard? Shark Tech, nature's best kept secret for strong joints and a powerful immune system. Shark Tech, the product with bite. Visit us at www.sharptech.org.
Expressed on this program by its guests do not necessarily reflect the views or beliefs of the host or radio network. And this program's sole intent is to help educate, foster critical debate, and help raise and discuss political and social issues which already exist in the public domain. Thank you and enjoy the program.
To this week's edition of the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We're streaming out live on the Alternate Current Radio Network and also at 21stCenturyWire.com. Thank you so much for joining us on this 31st of January 2016, episode 120 of the Sunday Wire. What an amazing week it's been. What a tragic week it's been, if you've been following the news. And there's been no mass shootings, there's been no terrorist attacks, but there has been an event on U.S. soil that has shocked a lot of people. The Oregon standoff has come to a dramatic end this week, culminating with the death of one of the protesters' spokesmen, Robert Lavoie Finnegan, days before his 55th birthday, an Arizona rancher. For all intents and purposes, was gunned down. There's no other way to describe it. Was gunned down by federal marksmen, SWAT team. I don't know exactly who they're working for. And the debate rages on whether he was reaching for his gun or not, whether they had a right to unleash deadly force on this rancher who got out of his car, is wading through the snow, and was shot and killed multiple times by agents, I guess. But we've covered it ad nauseum, but we'll still continue to cover it because there's details emerging in this story at 21st Century Wire. You can go look at our reports and see some of the details and how we got to this point right now. But we'll get to this in detail. We'll come back to this in a few minutes. This is obviously a really in-depth story. We're going to cover a few news stories first. We're going to get back to Oregon. And then we're going to have our first guest on at the beginning of the second hour. His name is Jason Casella. He's from Panda Unite. He was up there at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge outside of Burns, Oregon, last week or the week before, I believe. And he's going to share some of his observations with us and also talk about the work that he's doing, which is very interesting and, dare I say, inspirational work. Jason's going to share some of that with us in the second hour. And in the third hour, we're going to be joined on the live link from a guest over in Great Britain. He is a very interesting individual, someone who I've gotten to know, and he is going to share some of his life experiences with us. He's got a tremendous story. His name is Kim Upton, and I think he's got a lot to contribute to the conversation in terms of where the world is at and where the world is headed. And can mankind overcome the challenges that are currently facing it? What will that take? Kim's going to share some of his insights with us. It's going to be a really interesting conversation. That's going to be in the third and final hour of the show. But so if you've been watching the news, we broke a story. We didn't break the story, but we broke the angle of the story probably quicker than anybody else. The Zika virus. This is all the rage. This is the latest campaign of fear designed to paralyze society not just in Central America and in South America, where they are claiming that this virus is concentrated. This is a mosquito-borne virus, the Zika virus, and if infected, pregnant women could run the risk of microcephalia, which is a shrinking brain of the baby or the fetus in the womb. Obviously, it's creating great fears. We ran a story, great story, J.R. Smith article at 21st Century Wire, Eugenics WMD, Zika virus prompts disturbing call for a no-child policy. Yes, you heard that right, and we said it first. No-child policy, that's exactly what it is. The calls were being led by the government of El Salvador, which was the first government last week to advocate that women basically don't have any children for the next 2 years. So I don't know how they came up with this figure. And we looked into this. We looked into the Zika virus. And there's no conclusive studies yet that the Zika virus in these mosquitoes is causing this supposed outbreak of microcephalia in places like Brazil and in El Salvador. It's just not clear. There's definitely no peer-reviewed studies to make that conclusion. None that we have seen, anyway. So what is this? Is this the media just kind of running with this? It's absolutely crazy what the implications of this are. From a eugenics point of view, this is giant. This is huge. And you have to also look at the fact that this particular campaign of fear is seems to be running rampant through what can only be described as Catholic countries, okay, and in countries where people will normally have lots of children. Unlike Western Europe and North America that are currently in a negative birth rate, these are people who are actually having kids in South America, Central America. So World Health Organization is saying that at least 20 countries and territories in the region, including Barbados, Bolivia, Guadeloupe, these are islands. Barbados and Guadeloupe are islands in the Caribbean. Then Bolivia, South America, Guatemala, Central America, Puerto Rico, an island in the Caribbean, U.S. Protectorate, and, of course, Panama, down at the isthmus, this joining North and South America. So although the Zika virus has been documented since the 1940s, this is important. This is from the World Health Organization themselves. So they're leading the call, almost kind of stoking the fear. But within their documents, you'll also find some of the facts that might lead you to question the provenance of such a fear campaign. Although the Zika virus has been documented since the 1940s, it began its assault on Latin America in the past several months. Now, Does anybody believe this? It's been around. It's been documented since the 40s, which is going to lead me to believe, and anybody with a brain out there, that if it's been documented in the 40s, it's been around. It's probably been around forever. That's just when it was documented. And all of a sudden, the assault on Latin America just began in the last several months. And it's just spreading across Brazil, etc. So 1 million people have contracted this virus. The virus itself, it is fairly harmless. It has an incubation period of 7 to 10 days. In other words, it's in and out. Okay. There's been no studies as to do people have immunity to this virus. So little is known. Okay. So, but we're told by the World Health Organization that in the past 4 months, authorities have received reports of nearly 4,000 cases in which Zika may have caused, this is the key, may have caused, not did cause, not definitely caused, but may have caused microcephaly, that's the correct pronunciation, in newborn babies. This condition results in abnormally small head, deformed head, and associated with incomplete brain development. Incomplete brain development, which I might add is also a condition that seems to afflict much of our political classes, I'm told. But that aside, so Colombia, Brazil, and the Olympics are coming up in Brazil. I think I'll point that out. Already there's people, a lot of talk of people canceling their trips to Brazil. For this reason, this is not good. Okay. Is this war on Brazil? Is this some sort of, is there a subplot here that we don't know about? I don't know. But think about it. When in history has there been a call by international organizations basically telling women not to have children? When in history has this happened? I'm going to say never has this happened. This is the eugenics WMD, the eugenics weapon of mass destruction. Okay. Maybe these fears are well founded. It's possible, but there is no conclusive evidence. Yet, but there is a campaign of fear that is just running absolutely international right now. So later in the week, this is the headline. Is the Zika virus the next tool for forced sterilization, vaccination, and depopulation? So let's explore that for a minute. We're going to go to our audio clips. We're going to roll audio clip. Let me see which one. Audio clip number 4. Okay, now you think we're joking about eugenics? This is the way the mainstream media is reporting this story. I believe this is CNN. Audio clip 4, roll it.
Scientific officials are trying to calm fears over a fast-spreading illness with no cure, no treatment, and no prevention methods. The Zika virus is spread by mosquitoes and has infected 1.5 million people in Brazil. A Rio 2016 spokesman says venues will be inspected daily during the games. Officials will hunt for stagnant water where the mosquitoes could thrive. Most people who get the virus never have symptoms, but it has been linked to an increase in babies born with microcephaly, abnormally small heads. El Salvador is urging women to simply not get pregnant for the next 2 years. Colombia and Jamaica are also recommending that women delay pregnancy. An expert from the Yale School of Public Health talked with my colleagues, Michael Holmes and Amra Walker, about how the Zika outbreak likely began.
So the virus has been known to be circulating in Africa and Asia for quite some time, and then has caused explosive outbreaks in Micronesia and Polynesia, which then jumped to Brazil for reasons that we really don't know. And from Brazil, it's now spread throughout the Americas, including Central America and the Caribbean, and actually has more recently jumped to Cape Verde, the islands off of Africa. So this virus has a large potential to spread rapidly to areas where the mosquitoes that transmit this virus are abundant. And that also includes travelers from the U.S., from the United States, and from Europe, and from wealthy countries who visit endemic regions or regions where transmission is occurring and bringing back that the disease on, after their journeys.
That was Dr. Albert Koh, a professor of epidemiology.
Okay. Okay, so that's the basically setting up the story. Okay, now we have lots of talk about a vaccine is in development. This is another talking point we'll see in the news coverage, vaccine in development. So now, mind you, this is not like the Ebola scare. Okay, this is much, much more focused. Okay, much, much more focused. So this is an article at Activist Post. Is the Zika virus the next tool for forced sterilization, vaccination, and depopulation? Now, based on the rhetoric we've just heard and what we're about to hear, that's not a huge exaggeration. So the Activist Post article goes on, in perfect timing with the current attempted rise at the New World Order project we've been witnessing over the past several months. I'm not exactly sure specifically what they mean there, but the Zika virus scare agenda is focusing on fulfilling the global elite's depopulation agenda, as we'll see in a minute. But first, let's consider some history of the depopulation agenda itself. They're talking about the modern eugenics movement, which is very real. You can go look that up. There's links to that on our article, or Zika article at 21st Century Wire, which you can go research for yourself. So that's kind of more at the sort of flamboyant end of the commentary. Now, the other thing is the mainstream media are talking about developing a robo mosquito. That's right. A genetically engineered robo mosquito, transhumanist bug, of sorts, to basically unleash into and mate with mosquito populations so that their offspring will die. Now, what do you think the biospheric implications are for unleashing a genetically modified mosquito into the population to go and kill other mosquitoes? What do you think the implications are? Do you think they've thought out the implications of that? Do you think they think out any of the implications of any of the genetically modified organisms which are in our food, any sort of hybrid, chimera? That's such a crazy name, chimera. Do you really think? Listen to this, Robo Mosquitoes, audio clip number one. Listen to it for yourself and the vaccines.
It is a virus with an explosive pandemic potential. That is according to scientists. Those are their words. And they're words that you may never have heard of until recently. The Zika virus. It's, quote, spreading explosively around the Americas, according to the head of the World Health Organization. And the level of alarm is, quote, extremely high. The CDC, Centers for Disease Control, says that there has been now 31 documented travel-associated cases in 11 states and the District of Columbia. So what makes it move so quickly? The mosquitoes that spread it. They can be found almost everywhere in the Americas, and the World Health Organization is now estimating there could be 3 to 4 million cases in the next 12 months across the Americas. Our chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, joins me live now on this subject. So, Sanjay, what is the concern here? Apart from pregnant women who, if infected, can have deformed children, what is the concern for someone like me or someone like you or, say, the mosquito population? Where do we stand with this issue in the United States?
Well, overall, if you just take this virus in general, most of the people, Ashley, who get an infection, a Zika infection, will have little or no symptoms. So that's a little bit of the good news here. They say 80%, 75 to 80% of people will have few or no symptoms whatsoever. The big concern, as you point out, as people have been talking about, is for women who are pregnant, and maybe even more specifically women who are in the earlier stages of pregnancy. So that's the big concern. This association, it's still an association. They haven't determined a cause and effect yet here, but the association between Zika, pregnant women, and these babies born with microcephaly, which is heads and brains that are too small, is the real concern. That's where a lot of attention is focused right now.
So, Sanjay, I'm just getting some breaking news as we're speaking about this, and it's coming from the National Institutes of Health. They're saying that a clinical trial for a vaccine could begin this year. And while that sounds terrific on the surface, they're cautioning that this is a long development. This could take, you know, well over a year or even a few years to really develop. And a vaccine's one thing. Treatment is another. Where do we stand with treatment?
Yeah, well, we don't. You know, there's no vaccine, there's no specific treatment for this. Keep in mind that this particular virus, Zika, was pretty much confined to the Zika forest in Uganda up until just a few years ago. No one was really paying attention to this. The world in which we live now, Ashley, a world where it's full of globalization, people moving from country to country, weather patterns changing, all those things in part are fueling how quickly this is spreading. Not to mention, when you have a virus that comes to a new part of the world, a part of the world that has never seen this virus before, nobody has any immunity to it. So as a result, it can spread more easily as well. So these are all the things that are sort of driving it. The vaccine, hopefully, that trial will happen and we'll have some success, but it's not going to be, as you point out, anytime soon.
And Sanjay, one other question. This really struck me as fascinating, that there are British scientists who are trying to develop, and I'm just going to use this word, something called a robo-Frankenstein mosquito. It's actually OX513A, I believe, but it's a mutant mosquito, a male mosquito, that when it mates with this dangerous female mosquito, has offspring that die.
That's right.
That sounds scary, but it also sounds like it's a really good defense. Is there something to this?
I think there is something to this, and they're looking at all sorts of different strategies. This is to basically try and decrease the mosquito population overall. Hasn't been done before. Hard to know how well it will work. You're talking about mosquitoes, which have a very short lifespan, so there's lots of mosquitoes that come out all the time, and there have to be a lot of these sort of robo-mosquitoes as well to be able to contain that. One thing I do want to point out quickly, Ashley, though, is one of the closest sort of things to compare this to is dengue fever, also spread by the same sort of mosquito, also a viral infection, and something that has come to the United States as well, but it never was widespread. It's never been widespread. Living conditions so different in the United States. Simple things like screens on windows, air-conditioned buildings, do a lot. They may sound simple, but those things do a lot to mitigate, to decrease the spread of something like this.
Yeah, scary, though, that, you know, at least one country in South America is telling its women not to get pregnant for a couple of years.
I can't imagine. And look, I know. I just don't think that sort of advice was probably going to be very helpful. It probably just frightens people. We're going to get updated guidance, I'm sure. This is happening right now. I mean, this is an unfolding situation.
Okay. Okay. That was Dr. Sanjay Gupta, who's the CDC's mouthpiece at CNN. So Zika virus. Let's think about this for a minute. Zika virus. So I'm just throwing out a theory here. Okay, and we'll wrap this segment up and we'll get to Oregon. I'm just going to throw a theory out here. What do you think the possibilities are that is it possible to maybe say, could someone take this virus and, buy it? Or does somebody own this virus? Has somebody patented it? And if so, could they just get it and then maybe inject it into some mosquitoes and just kind of let it loose, as it were? Or a variant of it, or something like that, or even put it in a water supply in Brazil or something like that. Who knows? But then I go to the website called atcc.org, the Essentials of Life Science Research. So let's see. I'm looking at this website, and oh my goodness, look at this. I found the Zika virus. You can go ahead and Google this, atcc.org. I've found the Zika virus. Here it is. I can buy it. Guess who owns it? The Rockefeller Foundation. I'm looking at it right now. ATCC, capital VR-84, Zika virus. There it is. Year of origin, 1947. Owned by the Rockefeller Foundation. Isn't that interesting? And the Rockefeller Foundation, and also... Well, I don't know what their association is with the Bill Gates Foundation, but definitely big into vaccine programs and lots of other things. You can do your own research there, but I just thought I'd throw that out there so people could go maybe research that for themselves. But Planned Parenthood has capitalized on this. Planned Parenthood is in the wake of the Zika virus scare, that they're promoting abortion clinics or services, I guess, in Latin America. So officials from the abortion giant Planned Parenthood are taking advantage of fears surrounding the Brazilian Zika crisis to push for expansion of abortion on demand, interesting, through Latin America. So a number of cases of microcephaly, a condition that causes babies to be born with an abnormally small head and short life expectancy, have been registered in Brazil and are thought to be possibly related to the mosquito-borne Zika virus. So that's interesting. So you can go ahead and read about that on, do a Google search, Planned Parenthood and Zika. So they've woven it in to their public relations campaign. So this is the way we do business in the 21st century. When a crisis comes, all the opportunists, they appear literally out of nowhere. So that's interesting. Well, we'll be looking at that story. We'll see how it gains traction as cases of the Zika virus or it's discovered in the United States. You'll see a lot more people getting scared about this, but there's still a lot to be known. This is the point that we're trying to make. There's still a lot to be discovered about what is it, what is the nature of this, before people fly off the handle and start putting talking points out that women need to stop having children. So, Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, that's coming up on Monday, the Iowa debates, Hillary Clinton's emails, well, some highly sensitive, top-secret emails, which Hillary Clinton has asked to be held back until after the election. Those might come forward. That would be absolutely devastating for Her Royal Highness. And so Donald Trump backs out of the Fox debate this week. And so the Republicans had their own debate, and Trump wasn't there. Trump had another thing on TV. It was actually a good, brilliant PR move. He had an event. It probably got higher ratings than the Republican debate, and he raised loads of money for the veterans' funds, and it was a great success. So meanwhile, over at the GOP debate, Ted Cruz got the leading spot right in the middle. And we'll go to a commercial break in a second, but I just want to point out that it's really interesting. When Ted Cruz was the number one guy, this guy threw a temper tantrum after temper tantrum. He looked like a spoiled Harvard brat and like just having a tantrum on stage about the moderators picking on him. Can you believe this? This somebody who really wants to be president of the United States, and who can't handle these moderators from these network broadcasters or cable news broadcasters. I think it was Fox in this case. I mean, they're not that hard to deal with, you know. I mean, well, Trump just basically left the stage completely because arguably because of one of Fox's moderators, Megyn Kelly. But so Ted Cruz was just crying and bawling on stage. And he threatened to walk off and stomp his feet and sort of walk off. I mean, have you ever seen such a debutante in your life? This guy wants to be president. I don't think so. Talk about lack of leadership. So Trump's coup worked in his favor. I think he got another bounce in the polls because of this. And Cruz took a dive in the polls. So once again, outfoxed by Donald Trump. So there you go. So Monday will be the big reveal in Iowa, but in the big scheme of things, Iowa is fairly meaningless in terms of the election results nationally. So, but it's first in the caucus system is completely messed up. I don't know how anybody can figure out what's going on in Iowa, followed by New Hampshire, which looks to be like a normal primary. So it'll all start heating up. So great. Wonderful. I think the election's wonderful. The primaries are great. I'd rather have those dominating the news than mass shootings and domestic terror plots. So, and other false flags and things. So we're going to take a short commercial break, and we'll be right back. And we're going to talk about the Oregon standoff and what happened this week after the break. I'm Patrick Henningsen. This is the Sunday Wire. Stay right there.
Steve Austin, astronaut, a man barely alive. Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Steve Austin,
I'm Patrick Henningsen, host of the Sunday Wire, and you are tuned into AlternateCurrentRadio.com.
Smoking up the alleyways, used to save the way a man should spend his day. chase the wind. That's all a city life requires. And the days of vanity went on forever. And he saw his days burn up
like paper and fire.
Or have weak joints? Is it making your life hard? Sharp Tech, nature's best kept secret for strong joints and a powerful immune system. Sharp Tech, the product with bite. Visit us at www.sharptech.org.
Who finds himself drowning in a bucket of cream has two choices. Drown or fight so hard he churns that cream into butter.
Jimmy Graham throws down hard.
And simply climbs out.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We're streaming out live on the alternatecurrentradionetwork.com and also at 21stcenturywire.com. And after the show, we'll be up on iTunes this evening for your download, podcasting, listening, leisure. And before the break, we were talking about a couple of stories, the beginning of the segment when the show opened about the Oregon standoff. And it was dramatic, to say the least. And immediately, and we'll go into the details a little bit of this before our next guest, Jason Casella, joins us at the top of the second hour. But so what happened? What happened? There was a convoy carrying a number of people, including Ammon and Ryan Bundy, and another vehicle being driven by LaVoy Finnegan, Robert LaVoy Finnegan, who's a rancher who was the unofficial spokesperson of the protest up there at the wildlife refuge outside of Burns, Oregon. Now, what happened was it tragic, to say the least. Two cars. One of the cars was stopped, driven by a man by the name of Mark McConnell, and that car included Ammon Bundy and Ammon Bundy's private security, Brian Cavalier, otherwise known as Buddha, and also another individual. And the car truck driven by LaVoy Finnegan kept going. I believe shots were fired, according to the eyewitness in LaVoy Finnegan's truck. The 18-year-old Victoria Sharp recorded a telephone interview, which was uploaded to YouTube immediately after the incident. And mind you, the testimony by Victoria Sharp is in sharp contrast to the testimony which was also uploaded by the driver of the other vehicle, Mark McConnell, who was let go of police custody after speaking to authorities for 2 hours. They let him go. And so he was up there at the protest. He was driving. I believe he was armed, but they let him go and took the rest of them off to jail. They also let go the 18-year-old Victoria Sharp. Okay. So LaVoy Finnegan's truck continues. Shots were fired. He takes off, encounters another roadblock about a mile up the road. This is on a rural stretch of highway, an isolated stretch of highway, Highway 395, in Oregon. Both cars and there were other cars too, who were in this convoy, but they're on their way to a town meeting in the nearby town of John Day. And there was a community meeting and an event, and I believe the family, the Sharp family, were going to sing. This is what they do. They traveled around singing patriotic Christian songs, sort of like, I don't know, the kind of family singing group, if you will. So they were on their way there. The daughter was in the back in the car with Lavoie Finnegan driving, with Ryan Bundy, Shauna Cox, and Ryan Payne, who was the unofficial leader of the militia, I guess, up there at the wildlife refuge. And Finnegan drives into the snowbank, trying to drive around the police and federal roadblock, and gets out of his car with his hands up, and was shot and killed by multiple federal marksmen, SWAT team members, and federal agents. They were even coming out of the woods. Now, why is this important? Because the mainstream media immediately came out and called this a routine traffic stop. Okay. Now, what kind of a routine traffic stop has dozens of federal vehicles? I believe I saw a couple of similar to MRAPs or SWAT people carriers. And drones flying up overhead, filming it. Is that a routine traffic stop to you? I don't know. To most people, it's not. But to the mainstream media, that's perfectly plausible. And that's the language which they used. And lots of disinformation, misinformation was put out in the immediate aftermath of this. Lots of things were put out that Lavoie Finnegan charged at police. These are the words of Mark McConnell in his the YouTube video, which he uploaded afterwards, after walking out of police custody. And he claims that he was just up there hunting. I'm not sure exactly what his words are, but you can go see that video. It's widely distributed online. But he was up at the refuge. He was armed. He was with the Bundys. He was part of whatever was going on there, despite what he said in his video. And it's prompted a lot of people to question why he would put out a statement claiming to know what happened at a crime scene that he wasn't even at. Yes, that's right. He wasn't even at the scene of the shooting. Yet he's put out a video asking people to believe his version of events, and he wasn't there. Whatever he gleaned secondhand, allegedly from Shauna Cox and Ryan Payne, while they were all waiting in custody together. I don't know if they're in the back of the same paddy wagon or what. They're trading notes, but this is what McConnell claims. Meanwhile, someone who's actually in Lavoie Finnegan's truck, her name is Victoria Sharp, 18-year-old girl. She was there, and she's told a very different story, that he had his hands in the air. He did not charge at police. But he was irate, certainly, and he was daring the police to shoot him, and they shot him. So, because of Victoria Sharp's independent testimony, I believe, in my opinion, that, this thing went like a storm online. So the mainstream media's go-to guy was Mark McConnell. They used his video, Oregon Live, gave it prominence in all their reporting. Les Zaitz, their beat reporter for this protest, he gave it prominence, and so did the Washington Post, and of course the trash tabloid website, which is like a clearinghouse for all the agent provocateur news, which is called Raw Story. This is like a clearinghouse for all the sort of actors who are agent provocateurs. All their stuff ends up on Raw Story. I'm talking about what's his name, Cobb, from Nebraska, with the white supremacist community he was trying to start. That Raw Story ran that, and they had that first, and all that sort of nut jobs, including John Ritzheimer. Well, you'll always see it up on Raw Story first. I don't know why that is. I guess they have a line in with that sort of material and those people. So make of that what you will. But anyway, this was where the mainstream media was going with that narrative. Now, McConnell's testimony was the mainstream media's favored narrative, which was also law enforcement's favored narrative, all the three of those together. And Victoria Sharp's eyewitness testimony was kind of given secondary billing on all of these articles and reports, which we've detailed pretty good up at 21stcenturywire.com. You can go ahead and look at those and study those yourself. Okay. Now, What happened after that? Well, the FBI was forced to release the drone footage from overhead in a dramatic release. They said it's the unedited footage, although there's a number of cuts and breaks in there. And so there is a continuous timestamp on there. Now, the timestamp on the video that the FBI released, the date is January 27th, 2016. You can go ahead and look at that yourself. But the event took place on January 26th. So the timestamp doesn't match. The timestamp of the FBI's so-called unedited video doesn't actually match the time of the actual incident that we're told anyway. So this has prompted a lot of conspiracy theories, various types of theories. Now, one explanation might be, and if there's anybody here that knows about drones, find us some other drone footage from law enforcement in the United States, because the Oregon Live claims that the drones use what's called Zulu time, and that is GMT, Greenwich Mean Time. So all the drones are set to Zulu time. So that might be the case. I'm certain we'll be able to prove or disprove that. But anyway, that aside, I believe the FBI had to release something because of Victoria Sharp's testimony. Now, this is a perfect example of a citizen journalist or just a concerned citizen getting some sort of eyewitness testimony, putting up online, and it could be proved or disproved. And amazingly, the Washington Post, I believe this is an article by Mike Miller, it's one of their top writers, he called Victoria Sharp who allegedly claims to be a passenger. That's the words he used. So again, more mainstream media trying to discredit an independent narrative. We've detailed this and what the Washington Post set up on 21stCenturyWire.com. Now, another piece of interesting potential disinformation was, again, from the Oregon Live, from the writer Les Zaitz. And he said in his article on the 26th, immediately after the arrest of Ammon Bundy, Ryan Bundy, and the rest, he says in one of his paragraphs that Sheriff Palmer, this is the Glenn Palmer, sheriff of Grant County, this is the county in the event where the convoy was headed at the time. Glenn Palmer, who was sympathetic to the Hammonds' plight, called for them to be released. This sheriff, not the sheriff from Burns, but this is a neighboring county. So he had opened a constructive dialogue as well with the Bundys earlier in the week. And so Les Zaitz from the Oregon Live, it says right in his article, there's a link to it on 21stCenturyWire.com as well. You can go ahead and look it up on the 26th. He said Sheriff Palmer was there at the roadblock where the feds had the roadblock where the incident took place. It says so in the Oregon Live. Okay, I'm not making it up. So that piece of disinformation there was, which is what it looks like right now, that caused a storm, a huge virtual backlash online between patriot groups and militia against this Sheriff Palmer, who apparently was one of the good guys in this story if you're on the side of the protesters and the Bundys. So is this a case of mainstream media dirty tricks? I'll let you decide. Here's a report from News 21. We've got this on this is a video clip we've got here. We'll roll this. This is News 21 on the 28th of January. This is a local reporter. Where was Sheriff Palmer at the time of Lavoie Finnegan's shooting? Listen to this.
Show we're traveling to the Grant County on Tuesday afternoon to speak to community members and Sheriff Glenn Palmer. An FBI traffic stop during the trip turned deadly. Now Sheriff Palmer faces some backlash from militia members who think he set up Bundy and his members. News Channel 21's Pedro Quintana joins us now with more. Pedro?
And Danny, Sheriff Palmer is defending himself on social media as allegations of him turning in the Bundy militia to the FBI continues to grow. What you're about to see is a Facebook conversation between Sheriff Palmer and a resident, which he confirmed to me was his actual conversation. just 2 days after M.M. Bundy and his militia members were taken into custody, speculation and rumors continue to spread on whether Grant County Sheriff Glenn Palmer had any involvement with the arrest. News Channel 21 asked about the Grant County public meeting when we spoke to Lavoie Finnicum on Monday.
The county actually reached out to us to come and talk with them. They got a good sheriff over there.
Sheriff Palmer agreed to hold a public meeting in John Day. Finnicum said members of the community were interested in Bundy's message.
The community wants to hear what we're doing. I sat and visited with some of the people from Grant County last week.
A Facebook conversation with a community member has been shared several times on militia group pages. In the conversation, someone asked Palmer if he had been told earlier about the traffic stop. Palmer responds by saying he had no knowledge of anything about the plans or who was coming to the public meeting. He goes on to say, FBI and Oregon State Police know me. They shared nothing with me, and they know I wouldn't have allowed it. That is why I think they did it in Harney County. He says the federal government went in so they could stop the Bundy militia from getting any traction and momentum from surrounding counties. Palmer was asked if he witnessed the shooting of Finnicum. Palmer responds by saying, no, the shooting from what I hear was close to 4. Palmer says he first heard about the shooting around 5:45 that evening. Now, earlier this month, Sheriff Palmer was quoted in the Oregonian saying he supported the release of the Hammonds from prison and sending the FBI out of the region. In the studio tonight, Pedro Quintana, News Channel 21.
Okay, so there you have it. That's the Central Oregon local affiliate, News 21. There's links to that in our articles as well. You can go and check out the source of that. And we are all waiting, the sheriff might probably make a statement maybe in the next day or two confirming all this. But this is a perfect example of how the government and the mainstream media together can craft very subtly put out information that can absolutely cause a huge brush fire in activist communities. In this case, anybody looking at or supporting or interested in this particular event. So we identified that was the source of that early on in all of our articles. But after this report came out on News 21, it gave us further confirmation that what we're looking at here is a possible disinformation leak. You know, why would this journalist do that? Why would they do that? Why would that mainstream journalist put out such an incendiary piece, but very subtly tucked in the back of a paragraph halfway down the article? What would be their motivation? Well, it would be to set groups against each other. And this is exactly what has happened. But luckily, I think it's been caught early, and we'll be able to put that brush fire out with some truth. So what else happened? Well, the L.A. Magistrates Court, this is from the L.A. Times, so I believe that they've opened the, I think it's U.S. Magistrate Stacey Beckerman. So she has opened the sealed complaint, and what do we have? This is interesting. So one of the people arrested in this wasn't with the convoy. He was at the wildlife refuge. He got out of his car and walked into custody. This is based on reports and on what we saw on YouTube. His name is Peter Santilli, and he is a YouTube personality and has an internet radio show. Okay, this is according to the LA Times and according to the U.S. Magistrate Stacey Beckerman. Okay, I quote, and we're not making this up, and you won't believe it when I tell you what you're going to hear here. A significant amount of the FBI's information used to charge Ammon Bundy came from an activist named Peter Santilli, who was allegedly living inside the refuge and broadcasting live all of his conversations with fellow activists. At one point in the video, Santilli's cameraman is recording Bundy speaking to another activist when the cameraman seems to realize he shouldn't be broadcasting it live over the air. So the cameraman steps away and bumps into somebody. So I was trying to get away from that conversation, he explains. So, you know, regarding Pete Santilli's live stream from the wildlife refuge in Oregon, they say, the court says that, so that is where Santilli's broadcasts proved so useful to the FBI, end of quote. So what do we have here? Well, you know, you have these live streams pointing at parking lots, taking live stream images of all the cars and trucks coming and going from the protest site, license plates included, members of the public, everything, running all live over the stream. Isn't this amazing? Isn't this, so the FBI didn't actually need to have any cameras planted there. Well, they had their best cameras, and they could watch it live on YouTube. This is incredible. I think this is a first. This is like PatCon 2.0 virtual internet world. Okay, so again, The Guardian, another report. So during the lengthy hearing, U.S. Magistrate Stacey Beckerman ordered Ammon Bundy, Ryan Payne, Dylan Anderson, and Jason Patrick to remain in custody without bail. Okay, without bail. Now here's where it gets interesting. Beckerman then delays making the decision on a case of Pete Santilli, a conservative radio host who was a vocal supporter of the occupation, regularly live-streamed protests. He argued that he was acting as a journalist covering the standoff, but prosecutors contended that he is, quote, anti-government in his activism, and who has repeatedly stated his unwillingness to abide by court order mandates. So, according to this, Pete Santilli has court-ordered mandates that he did not abide by. We don't know exactly what that means, but he will be treated separately from the others, which is interesting. So we'll see. As far as the fate of John Ritzheimer goes, that is also looks like it might be treated as a separate case. So Blaine Cooper, who is another person who was in the refuge, managed to slip out magically, undetected, just before the feds surrounded the wildlife refuge after Lavoie Finnegan was shot. Okay. Now, this is interesting. Cooper has surfaced. He's appeared. Just heard the, audio clip from a internet radio show. This is on the SoundCloud page of, Trick Schneider. Trick Schneider on SoundCloud, and Cooper has surfaced, and he claims that he left right before the feds surrounded the place, and that he is hauled up somewhere in a secret location with 100 militia deciding what to do next. So this is all very dramatic, isn't it? So tell me or don't tell me what you believe or don't believe with this particular drama, because a lot of it is just unbelievable. So there's John Ritzheimer. So we'll talk about this and some other things with our next guest. We're going to take a short commercial break and connect our next guest. His name is Jason Caselli's from Panda, People Against the NDAA, Panda Unite. He's going to join us after the break. Stay right there. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We'll be right back. Tune in Sundays at noon Eastern Time or 9 a.m. Pacific Time for the Sunday Wire for 3 hours of action-packed talk radio on 21stCenturyWire.com and AlternateCurrentRadio.com.
away this ball and chain. Well, I've searched and I've searched to find the perfect life, a brand new car and a brand new suit. I even got me a little wife. But wherever I have gone, I was sure to find myself there. You can run all your life, but not go anywhere. Take away, take away, take away this ball and chain. Well, I'm sick and I'm tired and I can't take any more pain. Take away.
Do you suffer from arthritis or have weak joints? Is it making your life hard? Sharp Tech, nature's best kept secret for strong joints and a powerful immune system. Sharp Tech, the product with bite. Visit us at www.sharptech.org.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We're streaming out live on the Alternate Current Radio Network and also at 21stCenturyWire.com. Thank you so much for joining us. This is the second hour, and in this segment, we're going to be joined by a very special guest. We're going to talk about Oregon. We're going to continue that conversation of what we left off before the commercial break. We're going to take a look at some different aspects of it with our next guest. He is a organizational management consultant and with 12 years in the financial industry in public and private sectors. He is also involved in an organization called Panda Unite. And this is People Against the NDAA. This is kind of a cutting edge organization in terms of what it does and what it represents. It's really about getting the tools to people in the local communities to sort of take back, I would say, let's call it people power or real local democracy. His name is Jason Casella. He's joining us right now. Jason, are you there?
I'm here. How you doing, Patrick?
I'm good. I'm good. And Jason, are you in Idaho right now?
I am, yeah.
So you're in Idaho, and you know we spoke earlier on social media, and you know you told me you'd been up to the wildlife refuge. I believe it was last week or the week before, and had some observations about it. I mean, bearing in mind the news which has come out this week, you spoke to a number of people there, met with people, including Lavoie Finnegan as well, and you know I met him in passing. I don't believe we had time to talk when I did see him, but you had a chance to meet and talk with him. And I just wanted to firstly just share that with us because I think a lot of people would like to hear that, what your impressions of Lavoie Finnegan are. And we can get into talking about the other aspects of the protest and the standoff after that. But just tell us a little bit about, firstly, tell us what you're doing right now, and your background real quick again, and then tell us about your observations from the protest at Burns.
Yeah, so what we do is work on a local level to basically ensure that the local representatives are acting within the confines of the Constitution, which I know you know, back up our inherent unalienable rights. So we're just making sure that the body that is elected, that is closest to the people and easiest to rein in, so to speak, is done. So what we do is we pass a resolution locally called the Restoring Constitutional Governance Resolution, which we passed in my hometown. And part of the reason why I decided to go over to Ferguson or to the Bundy situation in Burns is because the founder of Panda, Dan Johnson, went over to Ferguson. And what I noticed, when you can look past the propaganda and the division, is there are a lot of groups out there that are fighting the same battles in different flavors. And when we can get past the propaganda and the division, I think that we could all work together a lot more seamlessly. And you know, when you do work together, you have a much better chance. So what I wanted to do was, you know, go to Burns, see things for myself. I actually ended up going with a friend of mine who ended up staying, and he's still there. But I wanted to, you know, experience for myself, not trust what I'm seeing and hearing on the media. And I did get a chance to meet Lavoy and the leadership team over there. And my impression of Lavoy was he was very smart, very peaceful, and he just seemed like a real solid, genuine guy, you know. So mm-hmm. that those were my impressions of him. Most of what I've seen was him talking online, but when I met him in person, you can kind of gauge the authenticity of a person when you're there. And I got nothing weird or anything you know, negative from my interactions with him at all.
Yeah, I mean, those guys, Lavoy, he's a real cowboy, you know. And the if you're not from the rural areas and you're not from those communities and you don't mix and match with these types of people, then, you know, you won't really know what they're like. And they are not the same type of people that you, if you're living in New York City or, you know, in an urban area. These are people that live, work on the land. These are people from big families, big extended families. These are people who are generally very spiritual as well. So these are, it's really hard for people like salon readers or people who read Raw Story to relate to people like that. And I think that's part of the big cultural disconnect in America. There is a huge cultural gap between those people who live in this sort of urbanites, if you will, and those people who are out in the countryside. So this is a huge obstacle to overcome in terms of understanding. And I think we see this manifested on Twitter and social media. The attacks after Lavoy Finnegan has been killed, on just the insults, the things said about Ryan Bundy as well. And I can go on and on. You know, it's, to me, looking at the culture wars in America, this really shocked me, to look at the mob, the virtual mob that just formed like a tidal wave and just unleashed itself in this social media especially. So, but I don't know if you had seen any of that or you understand that dynamic at all, but to me it's pretty shocking.
Yeah, and I would encourage anybody who is trying to learn more, or maybe visit a small town. If you know anybody that lives in a small town, try to get to know them a little bit more, and it might make a little bit more sense.
Yeah, that's definitely good advice. So you had a chance to meet, talk with Lavoy Finnegan as well, and by all accounts seemed like a really good man, great man, in fact, according to a lot of people I've spoke to. And you also met with the Bundys?
I met with Ryan Bundy. I also met with Lavoy's daughters that came to visit very briefly as well. Mm-hmm. But I got the same impression from Ryan Bundy as well. Just a very solid, you know. It seemed like he had, you know, really, really good ideas, very peaceful, of course, and trying to work within the system and try to make sure that the Constitution is followed in a peaceful way. So,
yeah, I didn't see the need for the way events ended up on Tuesday evening. I did not see that was necessary. I really didn't. I want to get your thoughts on that because you were up there and you saw the atmosphere. You spoke to people. We'll get to some of the more nefarious aspects of the dynamic in a minute, but just your basic first impressions as an observer. It wasn't, was it a violent encampment? Did you, were they insurrectionist or did you, how would you have viewed that just as a casual observer? You know, what was the impression you got of how things were going up there?
Well, everybody was breaking bread together. They were singing together. They were praying together. They were just, getting back down to the human levels and getting past, the labels that are out there, and it just seemed like a peaceful place.
And, so I didn't think it had to end the way it did. Unfortunately, it did. There's going to be a lot of people obviously arguing about what happened and, wasn't he, et cetera. And they'll take time for some of those questions to be answered. But, now the whole reason why this started, Jason, was because of the Hammond family. And this case, father and the son were resentenced, and sent down for another 5 years, I guess. And the father's 73 years old, so, it could be some of the last years of his life. But allegedly for a controlled burn and a backfire that they set, which went on to federal lands. This was all back about 15 years ago it started. Now, that was the original case. So there's a number of key issues here, like jurisdiction, jury nullification, for instance, and also public lands, just as a general issue. And also, I guess, the sort of feud that the Bureau of Land Management has with so many small farmers around the United States. But all of these issues have been absolutely pushed completely off of the conversation because of the more, say, I might call it flamboyant aspects that the media picks up on this event. And absolutely, it's about guns and the militia and all the sort of characters who are running around up there. So that's, to me, unfortunate, Jason, because this is such a key issue for so many people and Americans, especially in the Western states. I guess people in the East Coast don't really understand or care about the issue because those states, it's my understanding that they're on a sort of a different footing, if you will, as states than the 11 Western states in terms of how much land the federal government owns, says it owns, I guess, and controls, and jurisdiction, and just the sheer size and scope of the federal government's operations in the 11 Western states. So this is not, no one's really talking about this right now. This is something that to me is really, that's also a big tragedy, from the situation in Oregon. I want to get your comments on that.
Yeah, absolutely. There are major issues with jurisdiction and the overreach and outside of the bounds that the agencies that are unelected by the people are basically assuming, such as the Bureau of Land Management, who, keep in mind their name, Bureau of Land Management, not Bureau of Land Ownership, right?
Yeah.
So, that is something that, you can keep in mind. But there are a lot of other issues that are happening that more people can get around if we could get past, the division that is being driven by the mainstream media. I know that there are a lot of issues right now, specifically in my home state of Idaho, regarding mineral rights and things like that, which comes down to the same core aspect that you don't have control over or any say-so with your property rights and your basic human rights that are protected by the Constitution. So that there seems to be, you know, the division of, you know, the left versus the right. You know, what's happening in Burns is more directed towards the right. And then you can have mineral right issues and, you know, gas and oil drilling issues that are coming up that are more geared towards the left. But if you look at the core of the issues, it affects us all, whether you hang a left or a right symbol next to your name. And you have both sides that are either allowing it to happen or straight up voting for your rights to be taken away. And it's kind of like the quote, you know, if you have a boot to your forehead, does it matter if it's a left or a right boot, or is it still a boot?
Yeah, exactly. And also what, you know, in relation to what you said earlier about the work you're doing about, you know, the principle behind Panda. And if you're a farmer in a place like, you know, Burns, Oregon, or Harney County, or whether you're down in Clark County in Nevada, or you're somewhere else, and then let's say the federal government rolls into town and sets members of the community off against each other, offers to buy somebody out. Somebody says no, someone says yes. Federal subsidies are offered out to some, but not others. There's people who are struggling to make a living. I think Lavoie Finnegan, he had a lot of foster kids come through his ranch, and people would say the left-wing media shamelessly basically accused him of running a foster child scam. What they don't realize is when the Bureau of Land Management comes and says, you can't run a 500 head of cattle, you're going to have to run 120 head of cattle. Okay. And all of a sudden your ranching business, your farming business becomes unprofitable at that point. So people have to resort to basically subsidizing their ranching business, either by doing what they call weekend warrior ranching, which is getting a job during the week, ranching on the weekends, or doing things like foster programs with the state. Now, I'll argue that that was probably the best foster experience any kid could have, is to work on a farm with Robert Lavoie Finnegan growing up, and all the things that they had learned. And mind you, these are kids that have been discarded by their families or mothers, or some cases their parents are on social assistance, drug addicts, etc. So he's doing a public service and getting absolutely lambasted by the mob for this. But he's doing it to subsidize a failed ranching business that's failing because of restrictions placed upon him by the Bureau of Land Management, by the federal government. So it's a feedback system that's undeniable here. And wouldn't this rather be an issue of land management with the state? Wouldn't that be better for Lavoie Finnegan, like what you're saying with Panda, getting closer to the source of power in terms of decision making, rather than almost like a foreign entity in Washington D.C.?
Absolutely, and you gotta remember too, you know, if your backyard is dirty and has stuff all over it, how can you ask somebody that, you know, maybe lives next door to clean their backyard? You know, you have to make sure that your city council and county commission is acting on behalf of the people and acting, you know, with the restraints of the Constitution before you can ask somebody in D.C., for example, or even at your state, you know, level representatives. You can't ask them to do things that you're not even ensuring is happening at your city council and county commission. And that goes to, you know, making sure you're attending the meetings, because that's where all this stuff gets rolled out. And that's where the jurisdiction lies and where you could actually have the most impact.
Mm. And so has anybody from your, you know, from the groups and people that you've worked with or that you've trained and so forth, through Panda and your other work, has anybody actually run for office, or has anybody kind of got on the county council or local council or anything like that?
Well, we've had several city council members and a few commissioners either get not reelected or actually decided not to run again as a result of what our efforts have been. And these are people that have been, you know, reelected time and time again and actually haven't had other people run against them. So that's where you could see some change. And I do know of some people who have been running and have now run or are willing to run if somebody doesn't run against some of these people that have just been in office for years and years without any opposition.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Well, that's positive. So you're having a little bit of an effect, impact there on the local political scene. So shaking up any of those sort of, safe seats, as they call them. So that's pretty positive. I want to talk also about the nature of activism, but, just to wrap up the other issue, with regarding, Burns, Oregon, that I'd like to share. I mean, we spoke before the break about the LA magistrate, and this federal complaint, which was unsealed, and whereby the Bundys are being charged with, evidence that was collected by, one of the so-called, members of the media there named Peter Santilli live streaming, has admitted that the FBI were very happy that they got all this, footage from his live stream. And, this is leading us to, look at a lot of, people, in that scene up there. There's some absolutely incredible characters. And this could sort of reminds me a little bit, Jason, of, the PatCon, FBI's PatCon program, which I believe was in the 80s and 90s. And if people aren't aware of what this was like an undercover FBI program, which they wanted to infiltrate all sort of militia movements, especially, during the 90s, this sort of got a lot of media coverage, basically. But they're gathering intelligence and they were trying to infiltrate these various groups. This sort of hit its peak, as it were, on media attention during the Oklahoma City bombing, or just after. Because one of these groups was one of the ones involving Tim McVeigh, but it was interesting. The timing of it was interesting because it couldn't have been worse. You know, these networks targeted by the investigation were basically inflamed to violence by the Waco massacre. So this was a real, it was a fire pit at the time, but. The Hutari militia in Michigan as well. This was something that was pretty high profile in recent years. This was a militia movement that was kind of infiltrated by the FBI. And I can go on and on. You had Hal Turner as well, who was kind of an alternative media guy, very similar to Pete Santilli in terms of had his own internet radio show, would say bombastic things on the air, call for people to be, violence against, federal officials and so forth. So, I mean, I think the PatCon program is still going myself, Jason. That's my personal feeling here. And I think it's a lot bigger and more complex than it was in the 1990s. I don't know. Have you had a chance to look at this story or research that PatCon program by the FBI? Cause I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, actually, I had never heard about it until we talked about it a little bit. But it does seem pretty interesting, and you could find some articles on it if you were to just do a quick search on it. But it is very interesting, especially knowing what we know now and seeing what we have seen transpire over in Burns. So it's something that everybody should take a look at and keep in mind. As we are seeing more and more of these types of situations occur, there is, what we saw over in Ferguson that happened a few months ago. You have the water issue that's happening in Michigan, I believe, right now, where similar situations are occurring. So we definitely want to make sure that we're paying attention to things that have happened in the past, because those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it, right? So the more information you can get your hands on, the better.
Well, regarding PatCon, the thing that struck me about this is because if I look at the charges that they have against the Bundys, one of the main items there is the federal government's basically claiming there's explosives at the wildlife refuge. And they found explosives there, and they believe they had intel that they were planning to attack the town of Burns. I mean, hardly believable, right? But, and you were there, so is that, that's kind of an unbelievable scenario, right?
Yeah, that's pretty out there as far as that goes. Yeah,
it's kind of outrageous, and that's putting it lightly. So, but this is what's in, this is the main bit, this is like the meat of the federal operation. So this gave the justification for the overwhelming use of force, etc. Now, it could easily have been planted. The explosives that they say they have or they say they found could easily have been planted by somebody who was being handled by an informant or by an informant themselves. Now, I'm going to prove to you that this is possible. This is an article by the Huffington Post. This is from February 2014. This is an article by Ryan J. Riley, okay? And the headline of this article, you can go and Google it, Georgia men used Facebook to plot anti-government militia uprising, prosecutors say. Three Georgia men were charged in a federal court this week for plotting to attack the government and designed to trigger martial law and to encourage other militias to join their violent uprising. Most of this was bedroom fantasy stuff. But indictments were made, arrests were made, and they basically uncovered this so-called plot. And what's interesting is basically there was an informant. So on later on February the 15th, Cannon told another FBI informant the types of weapons that the man charged allegedly wanted. The FBI gave the cooperating informant 12 non-working pipe bombs and 2 high-temperature thermite devices given to him by the FBI, okay? So the three men met with the cooperating confidential informant who handed over the explosives to the militia guys, to the dupes, basically. So the three suspects were then arrested as the cooperating informant went to obtain another box of supplies. So he basically went away and said, oh, I've got to get another box out of the truck, and that's when the feds came in and arrested these fools. Okay, so this man allegedly encouraged members of his militia to review guerrilla warfare tactics, accumulate supplies, and prepare their families. And he told them that the guerrilla warfare primary targets included TSA, DHS, non-emergency FEMA, and roadblocks, etc. So one of the FBI's cooperating sources, who had no prior convictions or felony charges, but who was paid by the FBI, was supposed to meet one of the arrestees in Memphis on February 5th. But that meeting was scrapped. Instead, the FBI informant talked to him over the phone and secured chat on a website. There, the person using the nickname, this is the cooperating confidential informant working for the FBI, who went by the nickname The Chief, said the group would then try to restrain the violence towards the people instead, would target infrastructure instead. So basically this person named, whose nickname was The Chief, was working for the FBI, working all these militia guys to do things and to basically take explosives, which the FBI provided to them, and they arrested them all. This is almost, could be the identical situation you have up at the wildlife refuge in Oregon, okay? So all we need is basically to find out what happened and when, which we hopefully will find out when this trial unfolds. So I think it's amazing, Jason, because you're right. History does repeat itself.
Yeah, well, it's eerily similar to stories that we've seen, come out more and more, like, Fast and Furious, like, the stories that you've covered quite a bit where funding and arms have gotten to, the extremists in the Middle East, like groups that are called ISIS. And if you look at where they're getting their funding and arms and things like that, whether intentionally or unintentionally, it does sound eerily similar to this. And knowing what I know that has occurred under the Patriot Act and National Defense Authorization Act, declaring the entire world to be a battlefield, who were to say whether things could happen there that couldn't happen here? And it would actually be quite the opposite. What you allowed to happen, in other places, you allowed to happen here. And like Martin Luther King said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think when the federal government's involved, or the CIA, or whoever it is, anywhere in the world or in the United States, you know, here you have the sort of the honeypot effect, where certain people will act quite extreme in their public persona in order to attract what they call the worst of the worst, okay? And by doing that, they'll attract all the crazies, and then the feds can keep an eye and keep tabs on them and maybe even manipulate them to do little tasks and things like that, which is what this case in with the Georgia men that I just mentioned, which is exactly what the chief did, whoever the chief is. And so that's exactly what happened. But what's interesting here is it creates a lightning rod. So you mentioned ISIS before. So Al-Qaeda and ISIS, what they are is like a lightning rod for public opinion as well. And so it's like you create an extremist faction, let's say of Islam, for instance, and you militarize that, and then you give it political identity as well. And then you create this kind of offshoot, this kind of an artificial offshoot. And I think we're seeing the same thing, with some of the militia movements in the United States. They've created lightning rods. And I believe that based on the records that I have, all these various case studies, including the study from Alaska with that, militia bust as well, Hutari, PatCon, and the Georgia boys, and then possibly in Oregon, this lightning rod's created, and look what it's done politically in the United States. It's set people against people. It's set right against left. It's set urban people against country people. It's incredible. I've never seen such political division, in my life in the United States. And to me, it's kind of frightening. And I think the country's in a very different place than it was 30 years ago. I don't know what your observations are on that, but that's something that I'm kind of concerned about.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I like to pose the question, you know, what's going on in Burns and on the western part of the United States? What's different between that and what's going on, you know, in these situations like Ferguson and areas that, you know, are more, quote, supported by the left? You know, there really isn't much of a difference when you look at, you know, what's being done and what people are standing up for. They're standing up for their inherent rights, their human rights. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we just have to get past the labels and we have to see past that and remember that we're all human beings and unite together, you know, and that would be the best way to go about it on a local level for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at that too. You know, I'm looking at the Solutions Institute, and I know you're doing a lot of work on that front, and also the activist conferences as well. And so, what you're trying to do here is you're really trying to you've got some tools you've created, right? That are going to allow people that can just pick up these tools and run with them. Is that kind of the idea behind it?
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, kind of what happened around the same time that Luke Radowski of We Are Change and Stuart Rhodes of the Oath Keepers received child pornography. So did Dan Johnson, the founder of Panda. So at that time, we basically decentralized, made this packet of material and basically, you know, made it available for anybody to be able to download so that, you know, there isn't one person that, you know, could be, quote, taken out that would, you know, stop the movement. And we basically created these tools that anybody can download and use and gave the power back to the people to stand up.
So for those who aren't familiar, there was somebody planted a load of illicit images on a bunch of people's computers who were kind of in the liberty movement, I suppose you could call it. And so some people aren't aware that that happened. What year was that when that happened?
I'd have to look exactly, like, but I want to say was around 2014 maybe.
Yeah, 2014 or 2013. I remember seeing that story actually. But and so that kind of prompted you to move things to another level, didn't it?
Yeah, and it's been good, you know, and that's also you know, something that we noticed because we started going out after the representatives that were in D.C., which, you know, fall on deaf ears if you ever called your senator or congressman that are in D.C., the most you can expect is a form letter written by a staffer. And then we noticed pretty similarly happening at the state level. So by far the best way to go is with the people that are closest to you, the people you see at your restaurants, the people you see at your grocery stores, your city council and county commission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you really, really engaging locally. And I think this is something that people got away from during the 90s. And I think the hype with globalization, I think the internet had something to do with that. But I think there's, I don't know if you agree with me, Jason, or not, but things are coming, they're coming back around. The cycle's coming back around. So as everyone was spread out, virtually, there is a resurgence in interest in local government, local issues, local communities coming together, helping each other. Is this something that you're seeing in recent years? Because I'm seeing it in some places.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where the people's true power lies. And it kind of comes down, you know, what I talked about before. If your backyard is dirty, you know, that's your city council. If they're the ones that are not acting within the Constitution, how can you expect or demand that your state or your federal representatives are? And, you know, you that's hypocritical, right? You if you have control over your city council and county commissioner but aren't doing anything about it, not attending the meetings, not ensuring you have the right people in there, good luck trying to do it, you know, at the federal level, or even trying to elect a president that is supposedly going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to happen.
And what's been some of your biggest successes so far in terms of like what you've been able to pass through, what you've been able to get your local governments to recognize, and sort of hopefully change the course of the paradigm a little bit?
Yeah. So since we passed the Restoring Constitutional Governance resolution, we have been able to unite the left and the right a lot more. And now you have the quote Tea Party type, you know, members working with more of the quote, you know, environmentalist type groups, at least what, you know, would be referred to before, now working together as human beings, fighting and ensuring that their God-given inherent rights are protected that are backed by the Constitution. So mm-hmm. People that would normally not be caught dead in the same room together are now, you know, allies and working together, and there is something going on regarding property rights and things like that in Idaho that these groups are now working together on. And I think that once they saw that their representatives on both the left and the right would vote to, you know, basically take away their rights in several different areas, they had a light bulb kind of pop on, you know. And then we were also able to ensure that funding from plans regarding UN Agenda 21 were not funded at our local city council as well.
Oh,
so you can look at a lot of different issues that are happening at the federal level and the global level that are all being implemented at your city and county. And without your city and county doing it, they wouldn't have the resources, the time, the money, the energy to be able to implement these in every city and county across the country, if you think about it. So mm-hmm. if you can make sure that is taken care of locally, you know, a lot of those issues that you're worried about, you know, will cease to exist.
Mm-hmm. So, and you've heard of Agenda 30, which they just launched before Christmas. This is sort of a kind of adjunct to Agenda 21. I don't know if you followed that or not, but do they have funded mandates or anything like that for that program in local governments and things?
Well, what I noticed is they don't always spell out the actual name, you know, as you know, Agenda 21 or Agenda 30, whatever they want to name it. It would go more towards like sustainable development. There's uh-huh. some keywords that you can look at, you know, from doing just a quick little internet search, and you can look for that on your city council agenda every other week or however your city does it. And I have my clerk send me the agenda every time they have a meeting, and I scan it, I look at it, mm-hmm. and then I attend and make sure that, you know, these things aren't going to be applied.
Mm-hmm. And all these things cost money, don't they?
They do, yeah. And you got to look at, you know, not just the big names that you see, you know, you got to look at the keywords that you can find with just a little bit of research and kind of read between the lines, go there, ask questions, you know, bring people with you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just spoke to, I don't know if you're familiar with, or what, you know, what your feelings are on the fracking issue, but, you know, when I was in the UK, last year and the years before, that was a huge movement that basically grew up from the grassroots. They were basically dropping drill bits in like small towns right in town, you know, and plans, lots of concessions, thousands and thousands of wells to be drilled in towns. And, one of the sort of leaders, the advocates against, hydraulic fracturing in communities was, a man named Ian R. Crane in the UK. I don't know if you've heard of him or not, but, I just spoke to him this morning, and I was talking to him about what we're going to be talking about on this show. And he had a few words of advice, because basically they managed to simultaneously start 500 unconnected, decentralized, local anti-fracking groups in the UK. And they've been very, very successful in kind of repelling these mega corporations, who are basically in collusion with the government, to drop these drill bits down inside small towns. There's a lot of risks to the water supply, of course, and a number of other things. But what I thought was interesting, Jason, was his take on how they managed to basically do away with any hierarchical structure. And because he believed that the establishment is designed to infiltrate only hierarchical organizations. And he said they can't deal with decentralized organizations. So I'm going to roll a clip. I've got two clips here, but roll Ian Crane, audio clip one. Listen to this, Jason, and we'll talk about it after the clip. Go ahead and roll that, Hesher.
Well, I'm just actually driving back right now from an event in Birmingham, because today we had some 40-plus events around the country to raise awareness of the fracking agenda in the UK. And one of the points that I was discussing was the importance of having no hierarchical structure. The moment that any anti-establishment organization gets organized to the point where there is a formal structure, it will be infiltrated in a heartbeat. You know, the establishment is very, very good at doing that. It's been doing it for a long time. So the unique element of the UK anti-fracking community is that there is no formal structure. There is no leadership. Whatsoever. It is a loose-knit network of over 500 groups around the country, all operating totally autonomously, independently, but of course, like I said, loosely networked through social media. So, you know, people have access to what everybody else is doing, but nobody knows what everybody else is doing at the same time. So, you know, this is working to our enormous advantage. And so my counsel to activists is to step away from, you know, the intuitive process that, you know, you've got to have everything organized through a central hub. No, it's got to be totally asynchronous. You know, you've got to create a hydra that's got as many independent, autonomous heads as you can possibly muster. I mean, in my ideal situation, every community in the UK has an anti-fracking group, and even some of the larger communities have multi-anti-fracking groups, and they're all doing their own thing, but then when the crunch comes, you know, when they need to really get their act together to challenge planning applications or even physically getting come together at that juncture.
Yeah, so that was Ian R. Crane. That was actually a conversation right before the show. I was on the phone with him. But I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? Somehow, it's almost if by magic, they've been able to grow this thing on the grassroots, in the UK with absolutely, but they had there's some common principles behind all these groups, obviously. They share an objective, right? But they're just everywhere. It's incredible. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, well, you know, when you look at the situation with fracking with a little bit of research, what they're doing is they are forcing people, whether they want to or not, to allow a company, and many times it's one not even from your area, to force you to allow a drill to be done on your property, whether you want to or not. And the rights have been taken away either by the federal government or the state government. And when you look at what's being done on the fracking issue, and then if you look at what's being done, you know, with situations like the Bundy Ranch and what's happening in Burns, the core issue is the same. It's property rights. It's your human basic fundamental rights to life, liberty, property, the pursuit of happiness. So if you can get past the labels, they're basically fighting the same thing with a little different flavor. And what he was saying about decentralization is exactly, you know, why we've been so successful. If you know, it's kind of like what's happened with the mainstream media. As of 1983, you had six corporations owning 90% of media.
Mm-hmm.
When you can make a couple calls and have your agenda or your, you know, directive followed, is that easier to make a few calls rather than making thousands or hundreds of thousands of calls?
Mm-hmm.
It's a centralization and an easier way to control. So the more decentralized you can be, the more groups you have that are standing, you know, and operating independently, the better, because, you know, it comes down also to the resources, you know, on a local level, you can have a lot more control than you can as a people than what the federal government can do from D.C. You know, they need the cooperation of local people to be able to do what they want. And mm-hmm. part of why, you know, I looked at, you know, the issue of the National Defense Authorization Act as a big deal for me, because I know that there are a lot of issues out there. And at some point, you know, it's all going to come back to, you know, these terms like terrorist and you know, things like that. If you're going against the grain and going against what, you know, the main line is, that's where you get that label. And you could be standing up for fracking or you could be standing up for grazing rights. At the end of the day, it's the same difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Well put. And on the issue of decentralization, I think that's one of the reasons why We Are Change was so successful, is that it's completely decentralized. All the little chapters are basically autonomous. There's no sort of command structure there, and they just pop up all over the place, and they're based on some common principles, you know, doorstepping people with cameras and, you know, getting in the face of the power structure, as it were. But there are some common sort of, you know, principles there that they all kind of do, but it's decentralized. It's completely decentralized, and I think that's one of its big strengths, actually.
Yeah, it's kind of like the game that you played when you were a kid, right? Whack-a-mole. You know, you can hit one, but then five others are going to pop up somewhere else, and that's the idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than taking out the head of the snake, and then the body is left, you know, done. If you have multiple things happening at the same time, they can chop off one head, but there's going to be 10 others that pop up.
And inevitably, whenever you get these, you know, groups together, be it activists or people in what used to be called the truth movement, I guess, and anything, there's always someone who gets up and said, we all need to get together. We need somebody we need a leader. We all need to rally behind, you know, whether Alex Jones or, I don't know, Jesse Ventura or something like that. And we need to unify everything. And I was talking about that with Ian Crane as well. And there's one other little adjunct to that clip. Go ahead and roll the Ian Crane audio clip too. He's talking about someone wanting to unify all the fracking groups, and this was his answer. Go ahead and roll that, Ian Crane too.
Who was doing his level best to argue for a national anti-fracking organization. And, I mean, it eventually got to the point where I said, look, you know, we are as successful as we are because we don't have a national hierarchy. And I said, look, don't take this the wrong way, but I'm going to make the statement that, you know, those of us that have been doing this now are very, very suspicious about those who promote the idea of a single hierarchical structure, because we know very well that the establishment would love to have that. And we know very well that obviously we're causing the problems by not having it.
So this person wanted to create, potentially an infiltrator, wanted to sort of backdoor create or a drive or some call for a national unified organization.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, of course, I'm able to sort of counter that. And I make the observation, I said, you know, everything that we're doing is counterintuitive. You know, because everyone's been programmed to think that you've got to have a hierarchical NGO like, you know, Friends of the Earth or Greenpeace or like Lock the Gate in Australia, that you've got to have this national structure. But I said, you know, the establishment knows how to deal with that. They're, you know, those NGOs, they're an irritation, but they're never actually going to stop anything from actually occurring. They're just an irritation. I said, you know, what we've done is we've gone to a whole new level. So, you know, Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace are very supportive of what we do, but they're not driving it. They're not leading it.
Mm. Wow, that's interesting. Very interesting, isn't it? It's Jason.
Yeah. I mean, that just goes along, you know, with what we've been talking about. But you definitely need to have it be a decentralized, you know, effort. And it's a lot harder to, you know, like I just said, you know, if you're going to make a couple calls, is it easier to do that rather than a couple thousand?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Well, and as things wrap up in, well, so for now anyway, in Oregon, I think the legal drama is just going to be beginning. But, you know, just standing back, you know, and you know a lot of people in these communities and a lot of the people involved in that protest. And where do you think things are heading right now in terms of, you know, that movement that the Bundys were representing there? Do you think, what do you think in the near term? Is it fractured? Is they're going to have to pick up the pieces? Is there divisions that have occurred, or do you think it's going to galvanize the movement? What are your thoughts on that?
I think it kind of started off a little galvanized, and whether you know agree with how it was handled, you know, with them going into the refuge or not, I think that with what happened to Lavoie has really been sort of uniting people. And I know that they're working on a lot of initiatives on the local level through redress of grievances and with their city council and county commission. So, you know, they need to work on cleaning up their local representation, making sure that they are acting within the jurisdiction and the confines of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as they can do that, you know, they'll be in a lot better shape. The whole reason why this type of thing is going on there is because the city council and county commission either is not acting or willingly is complicit in allowing that land to be managed by a foreign entity. In this case, an unelected Bureau of Land Management.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also putting a lot of family farms out of business over the last few decades, and really changing, transforming the culture, and really damaging the local economy as well. Those economies aren't sustainable without a healthy agricultural sector. And this is where the BLM rubs right up against you know, the small holder, the small guy agriculture operator, the family business. They really, this is where the rubber meets the road, and this is the problem. So, and you just look at the businesses up there. They're talking about how, yo, God, things used to be a lot better. It's really tough now. And the reason is because there's just not a healthy agricultural sector anymore. And one of the reasons is that's because of the federal government, because of the activities of the BLM. So from an economic point of view, there's a huge argument to be made, you know, for this. But I think in the bigger picture, Jason, what we're seeing is it's a manifestation of globalization. And like you said, there's aspects of Agenda 21, that go along with that brand of globalization. So this is where we're at right now in the United States. This is where the real battleground is.
Yeah. And the forefront of that battleground is right in your local city council and county commission. That's where you could, you know, start to learn more and start to find out what's really happening at the global level, is right in your own backyard.
Mm-hmm. And give us your, before we go, Jason, you know, tell people if they want to get involved, if they want information, if they want to understand and maybe put into practice some of the things that you're talking about here today, where would they go? Where can they find that information?
Yeah. So if you're a group that is looking to get some assistance, Solutions Institute provides assistance and consultation for groups that are standing up for things like inherent rights, as long as you're not requesting the federal government to have more power at the barrel of a gun, essentially. That is a group that you could call upon for assistance, and that would be at solutions-institute.org. And then if you are interested in making sure that the laws of war and indefinite detention provisions included in a totally unrelated bill that simply funds our military, the National Defense Authorization Act, you can download the packet at pandaunite.org/takeback.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got links to both of those websites on our show page right now, right next to Jason's name in the show description. You'll see links to Solutions Institute and also Panda Unite. So you do want to go check that out. This is a really good opportunity if you're out there listening to really, these are the tools that can get you active right away. And, you know, Jason, the things that Jason's describing here and the principles behind them, I think a lot of people have these in common out there. So I want you to encourage people to go and check that out, especially if you're in a rural small town or a rural area as well, because there's generally a lot more at stake for the community than if you're in a big city. So do check that out. But Jason, thank you very much for your time and for joining us today on the Sunday Wire.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Patrick, and thanks for all your hard work.
No, I appreciate it. There he goes, ladies and gentlemen, Jason Casella. You can find out more about him and his work there at the show page. Just click through the links. We're going to take a short commercial break, and we're going to be joined by the live link to the United Kingdom from our next guest. This should be an interesting conversation with Kim Upton. We'll be right back after these messages. I'm Patrick Henningsen. Stay right there. I'm Patrick Henningsen, host of The Sunday Wire, and you are tuned into AlternateCurrentRadio.com.
Takes nothing. We draw our own designs. Fortune has to make that rain. We go out in the world and take our chances. Fate is just the weight of circumstances. That's the way that Lady Luck dances.
desires. My ugly ones born only to suffer. For the want of immunity or a bone of right. Well, who would hold the prize on the heads of the innocent children? If there's some immortal power to control the lady luck dances from the bones. From the bones. Why I'm here? Because we're here on the bones.
Suffer from arthritis or have weak joints? Is it making your life hard? Shark Tech, nature's best kept secret for strong joints and a powerful immune system. Shark Tech, the product with bite. Visit us at www.sharktech.org.
Back, ladies and gentlemen, to the third and final hour of Overdrive of the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We're streaming out live on the Alternate Current Radio Network and also at 21stCenturyWire.com. If you missed the last segment with our guest, Jason Casella, you do want to go back and listen to that. It was a great, very informative segment. I mean, the work that that Jason's doing there and the principles behind what him and Dan Johnson are doing there, I think is fantastic. I think it's accessible. I think it's practical. And best of all, it's free. So do click on those links and learn more about it. You can get active straight away in your local town. But we'll hopefully get him back on the show at some point in the future with some updates on some other issues. But our next guest, we're gonna transition a little bit. We're gonna go a little bit international in this hour, and our next guest, his name is Kim Upton, and Kim has for 28 years he's been a practitioner of the lay Buddhist Buddhist organizations Sakha Gakkai International. Kim has been involved with that, and also he is also before that was a personal coach, a breathing coach. And if you've heard of the Buteyko method, this was developed by Dr. Konstantin Buteyko, Russian doctor during the Soviet era. Kim was a breathing coach for 8 years. He's also somebody I know personally, and he's been through quite a lot, I think, in terms of personal challenges. Kim, I don't know anybody that's been through as much as you have in recent years.
Really?
It is really extraordinary what you've been through personally, and I think you definitely have a lot to offer the conversation. I mean, we spoke before about off air about, you know, there's a lot of problems in the world. Obviously, we bring up a lot of these things on this show, and it can be a little bit overwhelming, the information. And just tell us about your experience with looking at world events, looking at the news. And I know you've only recently kind of tuned into this show and looked at 21st Century Wire. You know, as someone in kind of the normal ebb and flow of life in the mainstream and watching the BBC and so forth, how are you processing this?
Well, I mean, first of all, Patrick, I have to really thank you for what you're doing because, you know, I mean, you've been instrumental in really sort of getting my head out of the sand. You know, I think since a very early age, I got very disillusioned with what society was offering me. You know, the the education systems, the, you know, the work opportunities, even what my parents were sort of saying, I sort of thought, this just does not ring true. There is something that's going on here. I don't know what it is. I haven't got the intellect or the experience to understand, but it doesn't feel, just doesn't feel right, you know. So I suppose I just became a bit of a dropout and, you know, tried to just do my own thing and find my own way in the world. And, you know, and stumbled along for quite a long time. But I think, you know, I mean, you know, just to give you a sort of overview, I mean, it was at 25 when I, you know, I got into a bit of a sort of dead end with the sort of path I was trying to take. You know, I wasn't interested in a career, wasn't interested in money, earning money. I liked money, but I wasn't interested in sort of, you know, devoting my life to earning money. I could sort of see that that wasn't a road I wanted to take at all. But I found this Buddhist practice, not really looking for it at all, but I just knew I had to find some sort of philosophy, some sort of teaching out there, you know, that rang true. And I think my ego took a bit of a bashing. Normally, you know, you used to say, yeah, I can do it. I can sort of survive. I can find my own way. But at 25, I'd been bashed so much by just how hard life is, that my ego dropped, and that allowed something to open up inside, and I became receptive. And very luckily for me, I met a couple, a funky couple living in North London, you know, who were Buddhists. You know, I mean, they were party people, but they were also Buddhists, and this was very refreshing for me. So that was the start of my Buddhist journey then. And in a way, I suppose, you know, I've been just trying to build my life on something that I can absolutely believe in, that something that resonates to the very depths of my being about the way, how I want to live my life, you know, from an early age, from, you know, my mid-teens. It was like, why am I here? What is the purpose of, why am I born on this planet? What is it all about? And the sort of, you know, the options given to me just do not ring, you know, just do not float my boat, you know. So when I came across the teachings of Nichiren Buddhism, in particular, I something just lit up inside me, because the conclusions that I'd come to about what life is about were absolutely there, enshrined in the Buddhist teachings, which, you know, ultimately goes back 2,500 years. So I think the wonderful thing about the Soka Gakkai is that they've reinterpreted Buddhist teaching to this modern era. So, you know, it's a way of understanding this philosophy of life in the context of the modern world, what's going on in this modern world. So, you know, to be quite honest, Patrick, you know, I sort of tuned out of the world events to sort of focus on, well, what can I do to build my life? How can I get stronger? How can I empower myself? How can I help the people in front of me, the people that I meet every day? How can I inspire them? I've got to inspire myself first. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to find something that inspires me from within. And then I can share it. So that's one of the reasons why my own asthma got worse in my 30s, and I didn't want to go down the traditional pharmaceutical routes that, you know, the doctors tend to take you down. My wife actually came back with a book about the Buteyko method, which you know about. I read that, and it was basically saying, you are causing your own asthma. You are not breathing very well. You're probably very stressed. You're probably hyperventilating. And this is causing a disruption in the body, which one of the symptoms is, you know, the symptoms of asthma. So that really rang true. And within just a few days of practicing this technique, my asthma completely recovered. You know, it was miraculous, wow. Really.
So were you using an inhaler at the time? Because I know a lot of people that carry around inhalers.
Yeah.
They've got asthma. I mean, how bad was your asthma before?
Well, I had it as a kid, and it never really got to the point where I was utterly dependent on medication. But then in my 20s, it disappeared. It went into remission. And then in my 30s, because of the stresses of living in London and, you know, and just I had a mortgage at the time, and my asthma came back. So it was like a stress response. And you go to your doctor and you say, look, I've got these symptoms. And what they do is they prescribe you basically a Ventolin inhaler, you know, and a bronchodilator and steroids, you know, inhaled steroids. That's the sort of what they do. You go in, you get your medications, and that's it. Nothing else, no education. Just take that effectively for the rest of your life, you know. So I didn't like that. I just thought there's got to be something deeper going on. You know, it can't be just a question of accepting that I've got asthma and I've got to take medication. So, I trained myself up. It wasn't easy. There were very few people doing it in the country. There weren't any trainers in the country at the time. I managed to find somebody in New Zealand, and I was going to go out there and get trained by them. But in the end, he came over here, and he was offering training courses. So the whole idea is that you have to take responsibility for your own life. You have to take responsibility for your health, you know, ultimately your life. No one else can do it for you. No one can make you healthy. You have to do it. So you go from a dependence sort of state to somebody who's taking responsibility. And I really resonated with that because, you know, that was aligning with my Buddhist teachings as well, which is sort of saying, as long as you blame society, as long as you look for the answers outside of yourself, you're going to go around in circles, and you're probably going to get more frustrated, more bitter and twisted as long as you sort of look for the answers and this has got to change. Try and change the structures, basically, you know. Mm-hmm. It's that, but the Buddhism says fundamentally that you have to change yourself, and then the world changes with you.
Mm.
You know, your whole worldview changes with the change that's initiated within your own life, you know, and then you view the whole world in a very different way, hopefully in a way that you can begin to engage, you feel empowered in, and then you find your own personal way of contributing something of value to this world. Like what you're doing, you found a niche, you found something you're very good at, and you're providing a service to humanity, really. I mean, you know, I mean, I'll go as far as to say that because, you know, it's something that needs to be done. But I suppose in some ways, not everybody wants to tune in and help the world in this particular, you know, by listening and reading what you're doing.
Yeah, I think you touched on something that's really important there. I'm also going to add something as well. You said that the stress came when you got a mortgage in your 30s. But
yeah.
If you break down the word mortgage in Latin, it mort means death, and gauge means grip. So it's death grip, basically. That's the Latin translation for mortgage. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, amazing.
Isn't that amazing? So that's a mortgage for you. But no, it's really important what you just said, Kim. You said, you know, if you want to change, if you really, there's a lot of people out there, Kim, that have a desire. They want to change the world in a better way. Most people I know, they fall into that category. And so you're saying that in order to do that, the first thing you have to do is you got to transform yourself somehow, or improve yourself, or change your outlook on the world. And when I was studying, I was dabbling in various different religious studies over the years, I saw one definition of karma, which was basically that you, karma is what you create. It's how you see, you create your karma. In other words, if you think you live in a security state and there's, you know, potential terrorists everywhere, you're going to see a world of fear. You're going to see a world that's insecure, and everything you do is going to be feeding into that, basically. So you're going to spend more money on security. You're going to, you know, get extra guns. You're going to put alarms on this and that. You're going to put cameras everywhere. Okay. And you're going to look to the state to give you more of that too, as well. So that's a karma. That's a type of a karma, right? That's the world that you see. Or if you think that the world is if you think you live in a dangerous or ugly neighborhood, that's what you're going to see, ugliness and danger when you walk out the door in the morning. But if you think you could be living in the same neighborhood as the next guy, but the next person's going to see a beautiful and friendly neighborhood. That's what they're going to see. Those are the things they'll recognize when they walk out the door. So you have two different people living in the same place,
yes,
under the same conditions, but having totally different experiences.
Absolutely. Yes. Well, you know, I mean, you know, I live in Reading, which is a, you know, it's a sleepy town. It's, you know, you gotta dig deep to sort of find, you know, the sort of cultural hotspots in Reading, but it's a safe town. You know, I mean, I've only been around here for 4 years or so. But, you know, you go and you meet people and they're all in different life states, life conditions. And so, like, exactly like you say, you know, they see the world according to the life condition that they're in. And, you know, I don't particularly want to go too much into Buddhist philosophy or Buddhist principles, but there is one central principle, which is the 10 worlds. And the 10 worlds are like spiritual conditions or energetic conditions that we all inhabit. All life, in fact, inhabits it. And at the very bottom is the condition of hell, which is a feeling of being utterly trapped and almost in a rage state of not being able to do anything to change your personal circumstances. So it's a sort of rage against, you know, it's sort of like locked in a prison or in a straitjacket.
Oh, I know a lot of people like that, Kim.
Exactly.
A lot of people. It's a really heavy one.
It's a heavy one. But, you know, and then there's, I'll go through them. I think it's interesting, you know, to sort of to examine these, you know. And then there's the world of hunger, which is this constant desire it's almost like your whole life has become an empty void and you need to fill it with something. You need to fill it with something. And you're externalizing, saying, well, if I get wealth, if I get loads of money, if I move here, if I get a girlfriend or a boyfriend, I'll be happy. So it's looking outside. It's this constant state of hunger for something that even when you get it, you're still in that state. And there's something else that you need. There's something else that, you direct that hunger state to something else that you think hopefully will make you happy. But it's a perpetual state of feeling unsatisfied with life.
Yeah. You know?
And then there's animality. Now, animality is very interesting because it's the state of instinct. And this is where fear, that state of fear, it's an instinctual thing that actually, you know, these 10 worlds have a positive and a negative manifestation. So like you're describing, these people living in the same town, but one living in a state of fear and that whole world becomes a projection of that fear is a good way of describing it. Mm-hmm. But the positive side is the sort of instinct to recognize true danger, you know, like all animals have.
Yes.
You know, that instinct, that animality, that's why it's called that. So it depends whether you're in the negative aspects of animality or hunger, because hunger, the positive aspect of hunger is that you really want to fight for world peace. You want to fight to create a better world. You desire and hunger to improve your own life.
Mm-hmm.
So do you understand? So that there is a, we call it an enlightened aspect to these states and a deluded aspect to these states.
Well, okay.
Do you understand? So there's a duality that exists in life, a delusive reality and an enlightened reality or aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Which one are you manifesting? That's the key. You know, is it motivated by a negative aspect or, talking about Star Wars, the new movie coming out, they talk about the Force, but there's the dark side and then there's the light, you know, mm-hmm. which is very universal. It's a very universal theme. The eternal battle of light and dark, if you like, or good and evil. So, and then you go all the way through, you know, you've got anger. Anger is a very, very dominant force in this world today, you know, and it very much drives the ego and this insatiable desire for power and control over other people. So a lot of what you do is try to expose these claws within the sort of institutions and corporations and the deep state, you know, the sort of people behind the scenes that I feel are very much in the grip of this sort of dark sort of, you know, dark energy, you know, this negative energy that's inherent in life, you know, and it manifests. In Buddhism, we talk about a sort of allegorical figure called the devil of the sixth heaven, the highest realm of desire. And this energy within life itself uses other people to enrich itself. So it uses it uses other people to feed its power, feed its sort of warped joy of living. And I feel that a lot of the people that are causing all the problems on this planet, you know, the wars, the disparity between rich and poor, the lack of equality, are in the grip of this devil of sixth heaven, you know, as Buddhists say. You know, it's a sort of possession, but it's sort of, you know, it's thing. It doesn't have to be in the realms I think you can actually root it in what you see around you. You know, a tyrannical boss at work.
Yeah.
For instance, you know, it's very real. It's very in our face. It can be the bully that you just come across going out socializing. You see these people consumed by their ego and this you know, desire to sort of dominate others. So it's inherent within our society on many, many levels. And you know, and I could go on with the 10 worlds, but of course I'll jump to the 10th world, which is the state of enlightenment, which is Buddha, the Buddha nature, which Buddhism teaches is in everything, in every person's life. Even the evilest people on the planet, even Margaret Thatcher, even Adolf Hitler, have the potential for enlightenment. You know, I think that's another thing that Buddhism always focuses on, is redemption. There's always the potential for redemption of the most tyrannical human beings on the planet.
And I thought it was quite refreshing, you know, when George W. Bush left office and he basically retreated to his ranch and he was like doing watercolor paintings for like 2 years. I mean, in a way, it sort of, I don't know, it did make me happy on a level, because I thought, wow, you know, this is a guy that, you know, the most hated man in the world for 8 years, and he's just retreated into sort of watercolors for 2 years, you know, painting his toes in the bathtub, you know what I mean?
Well, yes, but true redemption is actually coming clean and actually, you know, and deeply, deeply apologizing for the chaos and death and destruction that...
Oh, we're waiting for that one. We're waiting for that one. Yeah.
You know, I mean, whether that's going to happen, you know, in the course of his lifetime, who knows? But normally, you know, the law of karma, the cosmic law of karma is very, very, very strict. And you know, you've touched upon karma, and karma is formed by, you know, thoughts, words, and deeds, and of course, deeds create the strongest karma, you know, the heaviest karma, depending on what deeds you take. It could be for good, it could be for evil, depending on what your state of life is in. And these are etched into such a, you know, Carl Jung talks about the collective unconscious, which is a very deep level below the subconscious. We call it, as Buddhists, the karmic storehouse, or we call it the eighth consciousness, which actually transmigrates from one lifetime to another. So now we're getting into the sort of the more profound.
That's interesting. Interesting. Yeah.
So you don't escape it. Even death does not absolve you of, you know, in the Buddhist teachings, of the deeds that you've done. And normally when people reach the point of death, then everything is uncovered and revealed, and the true state. It's a bit like Dorian Gray, the story of Dorian Gray, Oscar Wilde.
Now, just so people don't think you're getting too, metaphysical or New Agey here, Kim, what you're talking about, you can actually give a logical explanation to describe that phenomenon which you've just talked about, right? I mean, how would the logical, it's kind of based on cause and effect a lot too, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, it's quite profound, you know. It's not straightforward cause and effect. It's called the simultaneity of cause and effect, which means that every cause that you make, at the same time, a latent effect is made in your life. So say, you know, I went out tomorrow and I did some despicable things to people. You know, I behaved in an atrocious way and caused a lot of pain and suffering. You know, I won't go into details of that, but say I did that.
And your name is John McCain.
Exactly. Yes.
Just for argument's sake, we're just role playing.
You know, I'm spouting lies. I'm trying to, the things you're revealing, the things you're uncovering through the work that you're doing. For instance, but say I was one of those people that went out and did despicable things and caused a lot of pain and suffering out there.
Tony Blair.
Sorry?
Tony Blair.
Okay. I don't name names, by the way, but anyway.
No, carry on.
Anyway, so, you know, that at the same time as doing that, Buddhism teaches that due to the simultaneity of cause and effect, there is a latent effect lodged in your life. which will become manifest at some point in the future when conditions, you know, when the conditions arise for that to happen. So in a way, it's what goes around comes around, you know. Mm-hmm. It's that well-known phrase, you know, that is a very easy way of sort of explaining the cause and effect. You can't get away with anything, and even death is not an escape. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say, well, these tyrants who have been murdering people and raping the land and stealing all the nation's wealth, you know, they seem to be living amazing, you know, they don't seem to be getting any... They're not imprisoned, they're not hanged, they're not killed, you know. But Buddhism explains that everything that you do, everything that you say, and everything that you think creates a cause for some future manifestation of what you've done there. That there is this law. It's like gravity. It's like, you know, it's something that is just there that begins to happen. And, you know, I mean, I think through my Buddhist practice, I realize that. I realize that if I don't live my life fully, if I don't commit to my life every day to do the best I possibly can, I start to suffer. You know, mm-hmm. I start to get depressed.
Yeah.
I start to lose my energy. My vitality goes. My sense of connection with this world begins to sort of close in around me because I'm not fighting to do the best I can with the unique abilities that I have. Everyone has unique abilities, but mm-hmm. so many people don't believe that they have unique.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the failure of the education system, the failure of our society to not recognize that every single human being, you know, has a dignity and has infinite potential. You know, and there's a lot of factions out there that would like to keep it that way, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
Keep people ignorant. Keep people disempowered. Keep people, you know, in a hypnotic state, you know, by this mass, you know, propaganda machine that is the mainstream media that you know that keeps pumping this skewed, totally deluded way of viewing the world upon the people and say this is the truth and believe this, you know. So, you know, it's you know, I think that. You know, Buddhism, Nichiren Buddhism, the Soka Gakkai, is trying to awaken people by realizing that the only way you can really awaken people is becoming, in a way, one by one. It's one by one. It's meeting people. It's forming heart-to-heart friendships with people. It's listening to people's problems. It's spending that time treasuring each individual that you meet. And I'm talking about locally. You know, just go out in your street and find the people that are suffering and sort of give them hope. You know, find that capacity within yourself to help and support other people, because that ultimately is your own happiness. The more you can do that, the more that you can support others, the more you support yourself. I mean, that you know, again, is karma again. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for me, you know, I'm 52, but I feel I'm just awakening, you know, and I think your website and your radio program has in a way allowed me to take on the world in terms of what really is going on that bigger scale, you know. Mm-hmm. What is going on? Why are people sort of losing their jobs? You know, why are people really suffering? Well, you're getting right to sort of the root causes in society, and it's the trickle down, isn't it, that we sort of experience on a day-to-day level.
Mm-hmm.
that's
kind of one of the things that I'm kind of trying to do with you know, with this show. I know we are a bit cynical and satirical, and we do border on the absurd in terms of the sort of the farcical comedy aspect of some of this. But the reason I do this, and the reason I do this is because, you know, I run into people all the time, constantly, forever, and I've heard this for years, Kim, is like, what are you going to do about it? There's nothing you can do about it. They're too, you know, the corporation is too powerful. The government is too powerful. They won't stop the propaganda. They're all making $30 million a year to tell lies, etc. And it's very disempowering for people, and a lot of people are psychologically pummeled by this machine, and they've been their hopes have been dashed time and time again, you know, one thing after another. This week is a perfect example in Oregon to see the way the media just thrashed this man after he'd been shot dead by overwhelming force. And that's just one of many examples, Kim. And, you know, I could talk about the BP oil spill and whatever, you know, whatever it is, the Iraq war. And what we're trying to do is just empower people to say, look, you know, you don't have to be disempowered. You know, we're going to turn the tables on the power structure right now. And you're talking about these people on TV. They're just the same height as you. They weigh the same as you. They go to the toilet in the morning. They eat breakfast. They have indigestion just like you. Okay, they are not superhuman beings. Okay, no. What makes them superhuman beings is what people devolve to them in terms of undeserved respect or undeserved authority recognition. And I don't recognize people who lie to me on a daily basis. I don't recognize them as any kind of authority. I reserve the right to ridicule them. Mm-hmm. And do so openly because they're not performing the duty which they claim to be performing. Mm-hmm. And this is why we do what we do here, and we're trying to give people some basic tools of information, of a little bit of insight into certain issues or current events, that they can take that and share that with their friend and say, actually, no, what you're hearing on TV is not true. This seems more plausible, and this is backed up by research. You know, take a look at that, and that in a hopes, Kim, that we can change people's worldview a little bit and to give them a little bit of power, you know, give the reader a little bit of power for a change, you know. That's kind of the methodology behind it.
Well, you know, people need to, you know, have that balanced view, you know, have that view, you know, that challenges this what you're exposing is blatant lies, you know, and manipulation. And I think, you know, that definitely needs to be done. And I really liked a couple of shows back, the Irish guy who has the talk show.
Richie Allen.
Yeah. I really liked his approach, because in a way what he was sort of saying is that you have to be part of the system to change it. You know, you can't sit on the outside and criticize the system, because the system's too powerful.
Yeah.
You know, you have to engage with it. You have to find ways to engage with it. You have to sort of infiltrate it in a way that you transform it from within. And I know that, you know, there's a lot of people who are incredibly committed to making the world a more peaceful place, a better place, a more just place, a more honest place. And they're committed to going to their fields of specialization, whether it's the media or politics or medicine or whatever, because they know that the only way it's going to change is from within, you know. Mm. That to sit on the outside and then criticize it, it's not going to change a thing. And if, you know, if we try and go into that revolution thing, well, that you know, the revolution has to come from within. You know, I feel we talk about attaining enlightenment. The modern version, or the contemporary way of describing enlightenment, the Buddha's enlightenment, is doing your human revolution, which is about this change of heart from within. And, you know, that the only way that we can build peace is, first of all, in our own hearts. We have to create peace, and we have to create an incredibly strong desire for the world to become, you know, peaceful, not by attacking, not by venting our anger. I mean, certainly righteous anger and a sense of, from a sense of injustice is absolutely needed. But, that, you know, that's very specific. You know, if somebody is doing something to oneself that is degrade, you know, disrespecting you, it could be your boss, it could be a friend, it could be your brother, it could be somebody, you know, then if you're coming from a sense of justice, then it, you know, it isn't an attack. It's actually trying to help that person realize what they're doing, mm-hmm. you know, and hope, and trying to awaken them to actually that what they're doing is just not acceptable. So, of course, you know, I feel the way people can empower themselves fundamentally is by engaging in their local communities. And when they see people who are disrespecting themselves or disrespecting, you know, other people or yourself, then to find the courage and compassion and wisdom to be able to face it head on, mm-hmm. and deal with it, you know. And it requires a lot of inner strength to be able to do that in a way that you don't end up on the same level as them and start attacking and shouting and screaming at them.
Yeah. Well, our last guest, Jason Casella, that's exactly what his organization, what's one of the principles that they embody, is that this is about getting engaged in your local community and really working on the ground level. And that's how you build up. That's how you build your going forward, going up as a society or civilization, has to be done at local level first. So, that's really inspirational, and those words are not hollow by any stretch. Just go listen to the last hour and you'll see what we mean, but you're spot on there, Kim.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, I'm, as I said, I'm just awakening myself. You know, I've been, you know, I have to say, you know, you mentioned my personal struggles. Well, you know, I'm not really going to want to go into too much detail about them, but I think I felt very disempowered most of my life. You know, I felt very, you know, how can I really make a difference? You know, it's just me. You know, I struggle to get out of bed in the morning. I struggle to feel enthusiastic about anything in this world. You know, as you said, a lot of people feel this way, turning on the news, looking at papers, you know, just talking to people. So many people feel the same way too. It's easy to get dragged down. And mm-hmm. I was at a local Buddhist meeting this morning, actually, and it's just local people in the area where I live, Reading and Maidenhead, in just outside of London. And, you know, we have regular meetings where we get together and we encourage each other, you know. But we talk about very profound things. And a friend of mine gave a talk, and she mentioned something that I thought would be good to mention on your show. And it says here, the root cause of misery and suffering is that an individual cannot make a difference.
Mm.
The root cause of misery and suffering is that an individual cannot make a difference.
Yeah.
So that's how you... In a way, that mentality, that mindset, then takes away all your... It disempowers you to think like that,
yeah.
You know? And I think there's so many of us that feel that way, that are good people who want society to change. So, in a way, we have to unite. We have to encourage one another. And this starts off with the local communities. You know, the communities have been, I don't know whether it's a systematic, conscious destroy the communities. You know, the sort of local communities that I remember as a child was, you know, we didn't have the big supermarkets where people just walked around not talking to one another. You know, you knew your local baker, you knew your local butcher, your greengrocers, you met people on the street. There was a strong community sense in the towns. Now things have changed, haven't they?
The main component of the community is the core component is the family. So yeah. I think so the fracturing of the community, or the obliteration, I would the obliteration of the community is really a reflection, emanates from the fracturing and the kind of marginalization of the family structure. So that's the core component, and that's a tough one because we're really down the line on social engineering in that respect. I mean, we're decades and decades down that line of that agenda. But you can bring it back to home very quickly. It's just it's a mindset, Kim. I think it's a mindset.
I think, you know, we got the TV, and the TV has replaced the conversation. Mm-hmm. In a lot of families, and before the TV, which I'm not saying is a bad thing. I'm just saying that it has now become this instrument of dividing, you know, stopping people from communicating and having dialogue and being creative, perhaps as well. You know, I mean, before the TV, there were a lot of pianos in people's homes. People played music. People read. People played with one another. You know, So there's that sort of element to it. But, you know, and people are sort of timid of one another. You know, you go out and, you know, I mean, I live in Britain, I live in England, and I live in a sleepy town called Reading, which is, there's no immediate threats anywhere, but people are timid of one another. People don't know how to talk to one another anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to have a conversation with somebody at the bus stop or in a shop, it's difficult. You know, I mean, I try to make an effort, you know, and when I do and I break through, that you have these incredible conversations with very ordinary people who live extraordinary lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that's what needs, you know, I suppose we need mentors, don't we? We need strong community leaders to sort of help initiate that sort of shyness that has been created, to build those bonds of friendship again, and build which then creates strong communities and gives, and that's what gives people strength. And ultimately, what it does is that, you know, you build society from the community up, really, don't you? I don't know too much about the social engineering agendas. I know a little bit about it, but, you know, perhaps you know more about that.
Well, I think it's interesting that, especially in America, it was more pronounced. We have a different flavor of social engineering here, but in Europe, it's definitely revolves around socialist kind of democracy. Whereby the state in Europe, the state is sort of the ultimate sort of nanny, if you will. Whereas in America, it's still a little bit, hasn't gone completely to that point yet, but it's heading in that direction. But it's also, there's a lot of alienation that pop culture, someone might blame this on cultural Marxism and other things, but to basically alienate generations, in other words, to get teenagers to feel that it's a rite of passage to, you know, completely rebel against their parents, to get people in their early middle age to rebel against older generation, and then against the younger when you get older, and then the narcissistic 40-something, 40 is the new 30 and 50 is the new, you know, this kind of promoting narcissism. So it's created this kind of divisions between generations that's very pronounced, whereby families don't spend a lot of time together, don't live together, don't share experiences together, don't share responsibilities even. And those are the sort of that kind of cooperation within family structures and extended families is one of the things that makes for very, very strong communities. Mm-hmm. Okay. And a lot of people helping other people who don't have something, and charity, if you will, but I'm talking about real charity, community charity, not corporate charity. Mm-hmm. But real charity. And this is something that is really disappeared en masse in a very short space of time. I'm talking about, you know, like 20, 25, 30 years. It's mm-hmm. It's almost gone. So this is a big problem in my view anyway, because there's only one more person to turn to, and that's the state. Mm-hmm. You know, and what are they offering? You know, I don't know. I don't, not a lot, I think, but I'm not, you know, it depends. If you think, you know, a dole check of 90 quid every fortnight is a great thing, then great, but I don't think it is.
I was thinking about an analogy of the world that we live in, and you know, if you look at Gaia theory, James Lovelock's theory about the Earth being being a macro organism, you know, it's a self-governing, self-balancing system, then, you know, you could sort of say, well, if it's an organism to itself, you know, what sort of state of health is it in, you know, at the moment? And so then what determines the state of health that this planet is in collectively? How do you measure that? Exactly. You know, how do you measure that? So there are lots of sciences, you know, that sort of look at very specific areas of that. And then perhaps if you look at that, you can build up a bigger picture. But the way I sort of see it is that, you know, the collective consciousness of humanity, in a way, has a huge effect upon the, you know, it's almost like their individual selves. Of course, with all the animals and plants and all life itself on planet. But human beings are unique in the sense that we can adapt our environments way beyond any other life form that we know.
Yeah.
You know,
way beyond.
Way beyond.
You know, yeah.
I mean, you know, since the Industrial Revolution, really, and so we are completely transforming the world. Not altogether in bad ways, of course, but But because of greed, anger, and stupidity, which Buddhism calls as the three poisons, you know, the spiritual poisons that actually govern our behaviors. You know, if you're completely possessed by greed, anger, and stupidity, how are you going to interact with the environment and other people in the world? Mm. And unfortunately, you know, a vast amount of people live in those realms, live in those worlds. You know, they're motivated by greed. They're motivated by a dominance and wanting to sort of be better than others, you know.
You said you can't escape this from, you know, earlier you said, well, you know, you can't even escape some of these, you know, I guess karmic feedback loops. You can't escape them from death. But is this why, here's my question.
It's quite way out.
is this why so many, you know, elite, powerful people throughout history, you know, whether it's the Caesars or whether it's whoever, is so obsessed with, you know, immortality. In other words, carving a stone statue or a bust or, you know, having their building named after them or the street named after them or this, you know, the country named after them, whatever. Some schools and hospitals and so forth, this kind of obsession, with immortality through legacy. And, it's like they're trying to somehow beat death or escape that kind, the karmic implications of that, of that sort of, I don't know, you could call it greed or, you know,
possibly, but I think more likely it's the succeeding generations of people who want to maintain the power that erect these statues, mm-hmm. to actually give a focus of how they want to keep the mind, you know, how they want to keep the paradigm going.
So the point of focus, they want people to kind of stay, to fixate on that as a kind of
everything he did was fantastic. He's almost godlike, you know. Let's forget about all the terrible things he does, and there he is looking like, you know, some amazing, you know, eternal being. You know, they're immortalized in granite or marble or whatever. I mean, it's like, you know, the indoctrination in the you know, in China with Mao Zedong, you know, and China's now waking up to the fact that he wasn't a particularly nice person, didn't do a whole lot of good for the Chinese people. But
the chairman,
yeah, exactly, you know, and of course he was enshrined everywhere.
Yeah, he was.
For decades after his death, you know, and that wasn't him. That was the regime wanting to perpetuate, you know, the agenda, you know. Mm-hmm. More and more. So, but it, going back to the analogy of, you know, the planet, you know, and the state of health, if you like, that it's in, then I believe, you know, I do believe that the people who act in an incredibly self-centered, selfish way, and then try and pose their views upon other people without listening, without having true dialogue, all they want to do is perpetuate and replicate their agenda. They're like cancer cells. Mm-hmm. That's what a cancer cell does. A cancer cell does its own thing with complete disregard to the incredible, you know, unity of all the other cells around it to maintain the life of that being. A cancer cell goes, fuck it, I'm just going to, excuse my language, I'm just going to do what the hell I like, and I'm going to replicate myself there until I actually kill the organism. Mm. And that mentality of complete self-focused, that perpetuation, the ego-driven state that only wants to sort of perpetuate your own, you know, your own personal agenda, is basically, you know, like having cancer. And I think the world does have cancer because I think there are too many people who think like that, act like that, and unfortunately, many of them in positions of power.
Yeah, and they've done a really amazing job. I've noticed, you know, I you can tell, like, the canary in the coal mine, right? The canary in the coal mine is kids, okay? And if you look at how kids change their attitudes, maybe especially the 13, 14 year old, right? Because, or the 50 teenager, I guess, the kids are, their interests have changed greatly over the years, and now there's a kind of like very their kids are very, at a younger age, very brand conscious, I've noticed, like in terms of designer brands or the brands of things. Whereas they weren't so brand focused or obsessed, 15 or 20 years ago. And there's some other things that I've observed too, but the bottom line is that kids have changed. I mean, so people, those are the future adults. You know, mm-hmm. the children will be running the country. They will be running the planet, you know, in 20 years. So, so they're seeing things in very different ways and sometimes good. There's some positives there, Kim. I know a lot of kids that are very aware of certain things that I wasn't aware of. They understand technology in a very seamless way. Maybe that we struggled with it a little bit, during the noughties, the 90s. But so there's positives and negatives there. I'm not going to say it's all negative, but I'm also going to say there's some very disturbing things too. But I see pop culture, I see media, I see even adults encouraging narcissism, selfish interest with kids, and almost making it me, kind of almost pushing this on kids. I see parents doing it too sometimes, So it is a cause for concern. And I sort of want to go up and whack the parent on the head and look, what are you doing? You're creating a monster here, and a lot of teachers in school are going to back me up on this, by the way. Sure. I do think it has to do with what you're talking about, Kim. This is a kind of like a mass psychosis or a way of thinking or a kind of an attitude, if you will, that's maybe based on that hunger principle that you were talking about earlier, maybe, partially anyway. But,
oh, definitely. It's called the lower states of life, which are very much governed by externals. So you go into these states of life, hunger, animality, even more positive ones like just rapture, which is when all your desires come true. You win the lottery, or you get a boyfriend, or you get your dream job.
Rapture.
You go into a rapture state, but it never lasts. It never lasts. It's not something that is sustainable, and then very soon your circumstances might change. You get your dream job, but then, oh, okay, you see the reality of your job, you're in the corporate, you're in the corporate machine, there's a whole load of other problems come out. You can be in hell within 2 months, So I think the point of what I'm trying to say is that these lower states of life are almost, you become a sort of, not a victim of your, you can become a victim of your circumstances, but it's definitely an externalized view of what you're basing your happiness, your value system on. It's based on if this something external changes, then something inside will change. Whereas when you start developing the spiritual aspects of your life, when I say spiritual aspects of life, I don't mean airy fairy new age stuff. I mean very real qualities, that are a bit deeper than the intellect. So you can't think yourself courageous. It comes from the very depths of your life, courage, doesn't it? You think, oh, I'm going to be courageous now, and you're courageous. No, it doesn't come from a thought process. It comes from a deeper undercurrent of life itself. Mm-hmm. So, Buddhism mm-hmm. describes, the qualities of the Buddha state that everyone potentially has in their lives as courage, compassion, wisdom, and life force. So in order to be able to navigate this world in a way where you can create value not only for yourself but the people around you, your families, your friends, your community, and your workplace and beyond, wisdom, courage, compassion, and incredible amounts of energy is what's needed.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what's missing. People aren't able to tap these incredibly these incredibly empowering spiritual aspects of life itself. We're not taught, we don't know how to do that. How do you tap into that?
Mm.
We're so externally driven, what brands we're wearing, the latest celebrity, whatever the distraction is, there's so many distractions out there, aren't there, that stop us from actually looking at our own lives very spending that time examining who we are, what do we believe, trying to answer those big questions and actually try and bring out these incredibly strong humanistic qualities that's absolutely what's needed to change this world, you know, change our lives, but then ultimately that trickles out, changes our families, our communities, and collectively as more and more people do that, tap into these qualities, compassion, wisdom, courage, and life force, then that's, you know, I fundamentally believe that's the only way we can change this planet. People have got to awaken to their own inherent humanity and strengths.
And you know, the last question I'm going to ask here, because we're going to wrap up the segment in a couple minutes, but a big issue right now, and this I'm putting this question out to you because I know you've got a certain a bit of experience, you know, through your practice and what you understand it to be, to see other religions or versions, organized faith or whatever. There, a big issue right now in North America and in Europe, there's a huge rift, if you will. There's, some might call it, it's expressed in what people might refer to as Islamophobia, with the advent of ISIS over the last couple of years and the horror, the lightning rod of that extremism, and then the migrant crisis. We see a wave of you know, ultra nationalist, or I don't want to get into the political labeling and stuff, but you know, basically National Front type things, and in the United States too. You know, so basically, this is all predicated on the idea that, and I hear this from a lot of people, they're saying, oh, religions are evil, all religions are evil, we all need to be atheists and not believe in anything. This is the sort of natural reaction from a lot of the sort of left-wing intelligentsia, especially. The right-wing is just like, well, let's kill them all, let's bomb them, let's put them in camps, round them up and send them on boxcars, you know. So my question is this, with religious divisions, okay, is it not that religious divisions are basically superficial? So, you know, so you've got the political identities attached, you've got the various religious organizations, you've got flags, you've got symbols, everyone's got is it not that it's a different style, that the institution's built around it, but more or less they're all founded more or less on the same principles, right? Because I see this, I see a huge, this is the source of a big problem right now. And I think a lot of it exists in people's heads. And I wanted to get your take on this, this idea that competing religions, I'm all for religious freedom, Kim. I just don't like people at each other's throats over it.
Well, a lot of these so-called religions are masquerading as religions. They're not really religions because, you know, the definition of religion is a teaching or philosophy or whatever you want to call it that builds human happiness.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, any group of people that call themselves religious but then spread fear, hate, and war, that's not the religious spirit at all.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get to the true religious spirit of Islam and the true religious spirit of Christianity and Buddhism, it's about humanity, it's about caring, it is about compassion,
yes,
it's about courage, it is about wisdom, you know, these are the things, it's the human spiritual strengths that religion aims to build in people's lives. But the problem is that it's been so confused and taken and used for agendas for millennia. I mean, this is even within the Buddhist sects. You know, the founder of our religion was a 13th century sage called Nichiren Buddhism. And, you know, at the time when he was studying Buddhism, he entered the priesthood at a very young age. He was from a very poor family, and the only way he could get an education was parents giving him to the priesthood. And he realized that there was various schools of Buddhism in Japan at the time, all saying that they were right and were all offering different views of the Buddhist teaching. And so a lot of them were trying to curry favor with the government, trying to enrich themselves by, you know, government handouts and build beautiful temples, very ornate golden Buddhas, the whole thing. And, you know, his enlightenment really was to dedicate his life to actually saying, well, what does Buddhism really teach? What is at the very heart of Shakyamuni Siddhartha's teaching? You know, the Buddha that attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree in India, or it was Nepal at the time, 2,500 years ago. And what it was is that we are all Buddhas. This is what Buddhism teaches. We are all have infinite potential. We are all endowed with the dignity of life and can lead happy, fulfilling, value-creating lives. And I think the true heart of all religion is about that. Mm. You know, fundamentally, it's about that.
Yeah.
And anything that detracts from that is not true religion. It's not a true religion. Mm. It's in the guise of a religion, trying to, you know, promote a different agenda based on the three poisons of life: greed, anger, and stupidity. Deluded minds and spirits and hearts that are possessed by this dark side of life. You know, I mean, that's all I consider this deluded aspect of life, you know, that's wreaking havoc on this planet at the moment. So never has there been a time for people to sort of stand up and find their courage and compassion and wisdom, because that's the only way we're going to be able to deal with this. You know, we can't fight against this element. You know, it's in your own life as well. You know, there is no outside evil in and you're good. You know, we're all part of this this amazing thing called life. You know, so we have the potential to be deluded, and we have the potential to be enlightened. You know, our biggest responsibility is to bring out this enlightened aspect of our lives, which knows how to build a happy life, which knows how to contribute value to our lives, our families, and our communities. That's the wisdom of the Buddha, if you like, you know. Mm. And it's something we can apply right here, right now, in our daily lives. You know, it isn't about going off to monasteries, or it's about what's on your agenda, what's on your plate right now in your workplace, in your local community, in your family. Is there suffering? Are people, you know, at each other's throats? You know, how can I bring out these qualities to make a difference and somehow try and create a dialogue that begins to connect people's hearts together? Because that's what needs to happen.
It's all there for the taking.
It's all
there for the taking. You don't need to go to an ashram in India and sweep the floor for the Swami for 2 years to get enlightenment.
That's right.
It's there, right?
You've already got it. You just got to reveal it. And, you know, I mean, you know, everyone, I believe, has this enlightened aspect that you know, can become manifest. I mean, I just happen to have found this amazing teaching. You know, it is chanting. It is Nam-myoho-renge-kyo is the chant. Some people might have heard of that. I mean, it is, you know, around the world. We're in 192 countries around the world. It's, you don't like the word movement. You equate it to something that happens at 7 o'clock in the morning. No. I remembered that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it depends what is the heart of the movement.
Yeah.
Because these movements, you say, are not actually that genuine, you know, mm-hmm. that there's some other agenda that's infiltrated it.
Yeah.
But a genuine humanistic movement that focuses on creating value in this world, you know, I would use the word movement, you know, quite happily.
Yeah. Well, that's our task, Kim, to come up with a new word to describe that phenomenon, you know? So we'll come up with, don't worry, if we put our minds to it, we'll come up with a new term. Then we just put it out there and people start using it, and then boom. And maybe it'll be a better word, you know?
Who knows?
Be a better word. But big chat. I just want to give a big shout out to our members in the ACR chat room, the famous ACR chat room. So DJ B2. Elisa, I see Randy J, Spore, Stewart, 2-6, Snacky, that's used to be Snacks, I think, and the Jazz Demon and Whitebird seem to be active in the chat rooms. Thanks, guys, for hanging out and making it happen. And Kim, I want to thank you for your time, and also thank you for sharing your experience with us as well. And hopefully we're going to have another conversation at some point in the future, hopefully, and we'll be talking about some other stuff. But thanks very much.
You're most welcome, Patrick.
For joining us on this week's edition of the Sunday Wire. And also thank you to Jason Casella. I put in a link as well, Kim, to the SGI website so people can go and check them out. That's right on the show page next to Kim Upton's name. Thanks, Jason Casella. And there's links to Panda Unite and Solutions Institute on the page as well. So thanks, everybody. It's been a fantastic show. It's been a sad occasion this week with events in Oregon, I must admit. But this is an ongoing situation. We're going to be monitoring it and trying to see what we can find there in terms of insights and more information for you, the readers, this week. So stay tuned to 21stCenturyWire.com. I am your host, Patrick Henningsen. This is the Sunday Wire, and we are signing out. We'll see you next week.
Weak joints? Is it making your life hard? Charmtec, nature's best kept secret for strong joints and a powerful immune system. Charmtec, the product with bite. Visit us at www.charmtec.org.
Tune in Sundays at noon Eastern Time or 9 a.m. Pacific Time for the Sunday Wire for 3 hours of action-packed talk radio on 21stCenturyWire.com and AlternateCurrentRadio.com.